Chapter 21. Chandrasekhar. In 1971, Chandrasekhar was by most measures the world's greatest living theoretical astrophysicist. That was no surprise, because it had also been true in 1941, 1951, and 1961. If he had been better known in 1931, the honor would have been his then, too. Chandra had no actual first name. He came from a high Indian caste where one name was enough. When he was a student at Cambridge, England, he adopted the initial S and later the first name Subramanian, but these were only prepended conveniences. Chandra was the nephew of C.V. Raman, the Indian physicist and Nobel laureate. In 1971, he had not yet won his own Nobel Prize. That came in 1983. He had been a professor at the University of Chicago since 1936. Princeton had offered him a chair succeeding Henry Norris Russell, the greatest American astrophysicist to that date, but President Robert Maynard Hutchins sold him on Chicago by asking if he wouldn't rather make a chair famous than take one made famous by someone else. Chandra once told me that Princeton's evident racism was a factor. President Dodds had assured him that, despite his dark skin, he would be classified as white and thus eligible for full Princeton University library privileges. Chandra wanted no repeat of the way he had been treated as an Indian in Cambridge by the English. He declined Princeton and accepted the Chicago offer. Chandra and his wife Lalitha became U.S. citizens in 1953. They never had children. Chandra always wore a dark suit, white shirt, and tie. His manners were always formal. Living legend understates the situation. When Kip, trailed by Chandrasekhar, came into my office and introduced me to him, I felt that I was meeting a marble statue come to life. Specifically, it was the statue of the dead commander in the Don Juan legend, and I was to be held accountable for my scientific misdeeds. Not too many so far in my short career, but I could think of a few. In September 1971, Chandra, at age 60, had just stepped down as editor-in-chief of the prestigious Astrophysical Journal, and was unwinding by spending a semester on sabbatical in Kip's group at Caltech. He brought with him a graduate student, Bonnie Miller. It was a matter of pride to Chandra that the average age of his collaborators had never risen above 30. He thus intended to interact primarily with us, Kip's students. We went to lunch at the Athenaeum. Chandra ordered a salad, an apple, and coffee, the only vegetarian items. Conversation turned to the question, at what age does a physicist become a has-been? You are in your 30s still, of course, Chandra said to Kip. 31, Kip said, smugly. Chandra advised, you need not worry until you are 40. Then you must worry. 40 is the critical age. He continued, I do not say it, but it is said of me. Chandrasekhar at age 40 became tired of the struggle of research and became a journal editor. By the time he was done coring the apple, he had arrived at his conclusion. Great minds try to repeat past triumphs, but their triumphs were all too often right, but for the wrong reasons, and therefore the attempt to reuse those wrong reasons is doomed. This was apparently a favorite theme. Chandra, carried in his jacket pocket, and now showed us a place card from a 1955 honorific dinner in Israel. He had been seated next to Niels Bohr. Because of the alphabetical order of the seating, you understand. On the back of this place card, who knew what else Chandra carried in his pocket, Bohr had written PQ-QP IH2, his famous foundational formula of quantum mechanics, and then A+B - B+A = IL radically. Here L was supposed to be a universal quantum of length, an idea that was, in this form at least, utter nonsense. Chandra summarized diplomatically, whether this is right or wrong, you see that his mind was seeking the same success as in his youth. Kip countered politely that astrophysics was so broad a field that no one could become a good astrophysicist before age 40. But Chandra wasn't buying. You cannot become a good astrophysicist before 40, he said, only because the astronomers take that long to accept innovative work. He cited his difficulty in getting his stellar structure papers published in the early days. And if I did not happen to be the editor of the Astrophysical Journal, there would be no relativistic astrophysics published there today, he said pointedly to Kip, who was submitting most of his and his students' work to that journal. It was Bonnie Miller, Chandra's student, who explained to us that he should be addressed as Chandrasekhar by anyone without a PhD, but as Chandra by anyone with. Bonnie took it upon herself to function as a kind of advance person for Chandra, smoothing his way in interactions with our younger generation and making sure that we all appreciated his importance, which we did. She and I became good friends, hung around together at work, and socialized after work with our spouses, she often riding home with me on the back of my motorcycle. Her husband, Richie Miller, was a mathematician, a topologist, a visiting assistant professor at UCLA. She was about to get her degree, with employment prospects very uncertain. As it turned out, she was Chandra's last student. Bonnie was a fount of Chandrasekhar anecdotes. In the 1968 U.S. presidential campaign, Chandra so feared George Wallace's segregationist candidacy that he went door-to-door in Chicago slum neighborhoods campaigning for Hubert Humphrey. One can only imagine the reaction of the local residents to the alien appearance of this diminutive Indian man in a dark suit and black tie, a formal manner, and an Indo-Cambridge British accent. The unofficial end of summer for relativistic astrophysicists, especially those of us younger than Chandra's pivotal age 40, was the Sierra Conference on Relativistic Astrophysics, a kind of camping trip and tribal gathering that took place just after Labor Day in Tuolumne Meadows, Yosemite National Park. Kip and his wife Linda were going. He was a speaker. Sandor Kovacs, one of Kip's newer students, was going, along with his glamorous girlfriend Renee Mile, who was a Pan Am stewardess on that airline's famous Flight 1 and Flight 2, which, with intermediate stops, went around the world in opposite directions. Renee, who pronounced her name Renee, typically worked the westbound Flight 1 halfway around the world to Tehran or Beirut, had a 2-day layover, and then returned on the eastbound Flight 2. That way, she could be based in Los Angeles. Flight attendants who did the reverse were based in New York. Margaret couldn't go with me, so for purposes of sharing a tent and meals, I teamed up with Dave Schramm, a postdoc of Willie Fowler and Jerry Wasserberg, previously their graduate student. Schramm was a gentle giant, a champion college wrestler who dominated physically without the slightest intended hint of menace, but you always felt the hint nonetheless. The meal's logistics were soon taken over for all of us by Linda Thorne. Dave and I set off in my aging Buick at 8 a.m. We reached Yosemite around 2 and Tuolumne, on the far side of the park, a couple of hours later. Schramm's tent was huge, about 12 by 12, and he also supplied 2 tables, 2 lanterns, a stove, cots, and air mattresses. The two of us had it pretty cushy. Sandor was crowded with Renee into a one-person backpacking tent, but when you saw Renee in her shorts and bikini top, you didn't feel too badly for him. There was no conference administration to speak of. You just set up your tent and showed up at the open-air lectures the next morning on the grass. By dinner time, there were 20 or 30 tents of other attendees, but no sign of Kip and Linda, or more importantly, the food that they were bringing. We, plus Jim Wilson from Livermore, pooled what we had for a meager dinner. Even without any food to cook, Sandor was up just after sunrise to start a cooking fire. He was Hungarian and had escaped as a child with his parents and older sister from Hungary at the time of the 1956 uprising. Renee and I walked a quarter of a mile each way to bring back buckets of water. Returning, we encountered Kip and Linda's battered green VW van, going the wrong way. They had gotten hopelessly lost the night before, in Lancaster, they said, although that was impossible, and were just now arriving. Linda was soon cooking breakfast for us all. Lectures were in the mornings, and then around a big fire after dinner in the evenings. The afternoons were for hiking. Our first group hike rapidly sorted us by ability. Wilson, Sandor, Schramm, Kip, Linda, me, Renee, from best to worst. At the 9,800-foot summit, we found, already there, Jay Melosh and his wife, Paul Schechter, 4 people from Berkeley and 2 from Santa Cruz. They had come up the front face, free climbing on the bare rock. The rest of us were, by comparison, all wimps. Kip gave one morning's lectures. Among that evening's campfire lectures was a short talk by a geologist on the geology of the Sierras. This, or something like it, was requirement for our waiver of the park's entrance and camping fees. During the talk, an argument broke out between the speaker and a physicist who didn't believe that polycrystalline granite could have formed out of a homogeneous melt. The geologist responded with, "That's just the way it is, brother. Either you believe it, or else you pay your park entrance fee. When theoretical physicists can't solve a problem, they simplify it, often multiple times, until they reach a problem that they can solve. That simpler solution sometimes gives insight about how to climb the ladder back toward the original problem. Assume a spherical cow is an old physics joke about a physicist who went to work for the dairy industry. My problem with Kerr black holes, mathematically speaking, was that there was no known equivalent of the RWZ equation, that one that applied to non-rotating Schwarzschild black holes. Here I was, computer boy wizard, ready to compute, but lacking an equation to compute with. Gravitation is a tensor field. That makes its equations horribly complicated. Okay, what if I simplified the problem to a vector field, like the electric and magnetic fields? Maybe I could compute how much super radiance you get when you blast a Kerr black hole with radio waves. No such luck. No one had worked out the necessary equations, and I was not likely to be able to do so. Okay, another simplification, to a scalar field. Scalar fields are the absolutely simplest. A small embarrassment is that there are no known scalar fields in nature. They exist only in theoretical mathematics. Still, the people in Misner's group at Maryland had recently worked out the equations for the Kerr case, the unwieldy Brill-Krasinowski-Pereira-Fackerell-Ipser equation. These were all people whom I had by now met. Relativity was a small field. I would compute the scalar superradiance. Not so fast. The Brill et al. Equation was unwieldy, not just in name. It had the terrible property that it was non-Cauchy. Without technical details, this meant that it was hopeless on the computer. Okay, yet another simplification. What if I didn't do waves at all, but just imagined a Kerr black hole in a constant uniform scalar field, a bit like a constant uniform magnetic field? It wouldn't necessarily have its rotation axis aligned with the field. It could be at an angle. Finally, a problem that I could solve. I could even solve it on my own before Saul got back from South Africa with his new bride later in September. It took me a couple of weeks to get it right, but I had the fun along the way of talking to Chandra about it. He wandered into my office and let me update him on my progress. Sometimes he asked me mathematical questions related to a problem that he was working on. This was pure flattery of me, since he was himself a vastly better mathematician than I would ever be. The uniform scalar field problem turned out to have an interesting answer. The black hole hated to be misaligned. It swallowed energy and angular momentum from the field, generating a torque to perfectly align itself. This was a result of no practical use, but it was cute, and Q demonstrated that some physically motivated Kerr calculations were possible. Kip told me to write it up and submit it to the Astrophysical Journal. After a long back and forth with a picky anonymous reviewer, Stephen Hawking, I later found out, it became my fourth published paper. Bryce DeWitt was a respected gravitational physicist who did his PhD work under Julian Schwinger and made his career at UNC Chapel Hill and then the University of Texas at Austin. He was a man known for his gentle, soft-spoken charm. He was in town. The Thorns invited Margaret and me to have dinner with him. The men talked physics over cocktails while Margaret helped Linda get the chicken onto the barbecue grill. That was how things were done then. Bryce had been Schwinger's graduate student in 1946 to 1950 and reported that, in toto, he spent less than 20 minutes with the great man. He semi-invited me to give a talk at Stanford, where he was visiting for the semester. On the torque on black holes, evidence that Kip had been telling him about my work. Later, he described first meeting Paul Dirac, the famously eccentric British theoretical physicist who first predicted the existence of antimatter. The great man was out on a stroll, so the young DeWitt tagged along with him, explaining in great detail all the important things he was working on. He finished his monologue and was met by silence, Dirac saying, "Not a word, no question or comment." After a minute or two, Dirac said to him, "Do you know of a public toilet nearby?" Immediately after dinner, Linda urged Kip to go upstairs and work on his book, after which Bryce, Linda, Margaret, and I continued in conversation. Bryce's wife, Cécile DeWitt Moret, a mathematician and mathematical physicist, was founder and director of the famous physics summer school at La Huche in the French Alps. I was trolling for an invitation, but Bryce was non-committal. The Chandrasekhar lunch group was meeting now at the greasy Caltech's downscale cafeteria rather than the Athenaeum, its upscale faculty club, so that Chandra could get a more substantial vegetarian lunch. Chandra described his regimen for writing books, setting and sticking to an absolute daily schedule. 2 years in advance, he commanded his editor at Oxford University Press to meet him at Heathrow Airport on a certain date. He would hand him a completed manuscript while changing planes on his way to a conference. But then he fell a whole day behind the planned schedule. The heavens intervened. He had not included the extra leap year day of 1960 in his calculation and was thus able to deliver the book on time. One wonders at how close this is to the plot resolution of Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days. Surely the world's greatest living theoretical astrophysicist wouldn't spread an apocryphal story. There were small triumphant moments in the greasy, one coming when Feynman sat down with us students, and I described to him my intuitive proof that gravity must be the only spin-2 field in nature. Could he find a flaw? It took him a couple of minutes to understand the proof, then another minute, repeating it back to me to be sure he had it straight. Kippen Chandra joined us during this time. There was an interval of about 10 minutes during which Feynman was stumped, and everyone got to see. He kept running down various possibilities, then noticing that they were covered by my previous logic. "Yes, that's very clever," he said a couple of times. High praise. Alas, figuring out a loophole, he finally explained to me and the group that I had not excluded the possibility that the field could couple only to vector particles. Spin 1 in quantum mechanics, or little balls with snouts if I insisted that he make the argument classical. "That was clever," he said again, "but I kinda thought that nature," he meant himself, "would find a way out of it." Feynman was famous for his entertaining stories, later collected in books edited by Ralph Lighton. I approached these books skeptically because some stories that Dick told us students over lunch in the greasy couldn't be exactly true. His mother, he said, had gone to the Ethical Culture School in New York City. The children were assigned ethical quandaries to think about. When called on, one little girl in the class would always begin with, "Well, I don't really know one way or the other, but my little brother Felix says." The story ends with the big reveal that the girl's surname was Frankfurter. Feynman's mother, Lucille, was born in 1895, as in fact was Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter's sister Estelle. So Lucille and Estelle might in fact have been in class together. The problem is that Felix was actually 13 years older than Estelle, so the cute part, my little brother Felix, was an embellishment. Okay, it was still a good story. J. Robert Oppenheimer was another Ethical Culture School graduate. A pesky Caltech formality was that I needed to pass an oral examination attesting to my ability to do research. Since I had already submitted 4 papers for publication, Kip tried to have the requirement waived, but to no avail. My committee was Kip, Jim Gunn, Tom Brello, and Feynman. Kip began the exam by announcing that I was going to pass and that we should waste as little time as possible. Gunn asked me to explain the black hole torque calculation, so that his time wouldn't be completely wasted. Feynman, however, got the idea of that calculation immediately and wouldn't let me waste his time by continuing. Instead, he started questioning Kip on matters far above my understanding. By the end of the hour, he had disproved Kip's conjecture about the extension of my result to tensor fields and proved his own different conjecture, all by very simple physical arguments. Kip bet Dick a beer at the High Life topless bar that Weber's results would be duplicated, but not necessarily that he was seeing gravitational radiation. Tombrello, looking at his watch, moved that I pass. The vote carried unanimously, in time for me to go with Alan Lightman and David Lee, two of Kip's new students, to visit Sandor in the student infirmary. He had gotten dysentery from Renee, who picked it up in Bangkok on her round-the-world flight. Alan and David worked together on what became known as the Lee-Lightman theory of gravity. Neither stayed in relativity research after getting their PhDs. Lightman worked in astrophysics at Harvard for about a decade, then started writing successful novels. His Einstein's Dreams was on the New York Times bestseller list for 17 weeks. He became a professor of humanities at MIT. David Lee left science to become a CPA. and then vice president in a large aerospace firm. In 1997, he was a founder of Global Crossing, a global telecommunications startup that rose rapidly to a capitalization of $50 billion. Its 2002 bankruptcy was one of the largest in history. David, who had left the company in 2000, emerged untainted by allegations of accounting fraud. He became a venture capitalist and served as chair of Caltech's board of trustees. Saul, now back, was working many hours every day on trying to derive an equation that would enable us make progress on Kerr black holes. Unless and until he succeeded, my own work on Kerr was dead in the water. Saul had inherited the local custody of the Newman-Penrose formalism, not to be confused with the NP conserved quantities, from Richard Price, and was trying to make sense of its 35 coupled, and from my perspective, not computable Kerr equations. Over what would become 8 months, he produced pages and pages of careful handwritten calculations. Chandra often materialized to listen to our discussions. "Perhaps I should learn the Newman-Penrose formalism so that I can participate in the new excitement," he said to me one day. He was an old racehorse champing at the bit. After he returned to Chicago over the next several years, Chandra did more than master the formalism. It became the basis for much of his 1983 book on black holes. The old horse did run the race. A birthday party that Kip insisted on holding for Chandra, against the latter's wishes, was a somber affair. We were in the dark Athenaeum basement, sitting around a big table. Kip and Bonnie were trying to keep the conversation with Chandra going for benefit of the rest of us, but it was heavy lifting. Bonnie asked Chandra if he kept up to date on affairs in India. "No," he said. "My last contact was when Mrs. Gandhi came to visit me on her last state visit. Before that, it was Nehru who visited me, and I disapproved of him strongly." Then he said, "Let me tell a joke." We were all immediately apprehensive. If anyone was a joke-telling type, it was not Chandra. "How can one divide 16 lumps of sugar into 3 teacups, each having a non-zero odd number of lumps?" Silence. Finally, Saul ventured what we all knew, that it was mathematically impossible because the sum of 3 odd numbers was always odd. "Not at all," Chandra said. "Put 1 lump in the first, 1 lump in the second, and 14 in the third." He sat back triumphantly. There was a look of terror on Bonnie's face. She was wondering whether she should pretend to laugh or just try to change the subject. Saul again took the burden on himself and remarked that 14 was in fact an even number. Chandra said, grinning, "I would say that 14 is an exceedingly odd number of lumps to put in a single cup of tea." The color returned slowly to Bonnie's face. The fall passed without my accomplishing any science of note. I could easily appear to be busy, talking to Saul, or Chandra, or Bonnie. Jim Bardeen was writing a follow-on paper to our previous work and included me as second author, so we exchanged drafts by mail and occasionally talked on the phone. I got a phone call from George Trilling, the physics department chair at Berkeley, dangling the offer of an assistant professorship as soon as I got my degree. "But that was years away," I told him. "We like to plan for the future," he said. Kip was pleased when I told him about this and said that it wouldn't be my only offer and that I shouldn't act hastily. Chapter 22. Motivation. Jeffrey Burbage and his wife Margaret Burbage were British astrophysicists and longtime friends of Willie Fowler at Caltech and Fred Hoyle at Cambridge. These four had co-authored a 1957 paper, Synthesis of the Elements in Stars, that became known as one of the most influential scientific papers in the 20th century. Jeff had the jowls, neck waddles, body fat, and personal manner of an anti-British cartoon depiction of John Bull. Margaret Burbage was a small, chirpy woman. It was impossible to imagine them in bed together. Jumping a bit out of time, she in 1972 became director of the Royal Greenwich Observatory, but was denied the usually accompanying title of Astronomer Royal, the first such case in 300 years, and quite obviously because she was female. In retaliation, within 5 years, she had emigrated to the University of California at San Diego, took U.S. citizenship, and was elected president of the American Astronomical Association. Jeff, although he became director of the U.S. Kitt Peak National Observatory, remained a British subject. He was known for his support of contrarian astronomical theories. One was his support of Fred Hoyle's steady-state cosmology. Another was that quasars were not at great cosmological distances, but were relatively nearby, orbiting within galaxies. Hoyle's cosmology was decisively disproved in 1964 by the discovery by Penzias and Wilson of the cosmic microwave background. Martin Schmidt's identification in 1963 of spectral lines from cosmological distances in quasars decisively disproved local theories of their nature. Geoff never admitted that he was wrong, but because of his friendship with Willie, Geoff was always welcomed at Caltech. On this visit, he gave an embarrassing physics colloquium and met privately with senior professors, including Kip. Geoff was editor of an influential periodical, the Annual Review of Astronomy and Astrophysics, which was issued in book form once a year. Kip must have planted the idea. Geoff invited Kip and me, jointly, to write a review article on gravitational waves, the first one of its kind in any journal. This was something that I could do while stalled on other fronts. Review articles are different from research papers. The author is expected to have something to say about all the published papers ever written on the subject, even if it is only to dismiss them with a comment like, "Other authors have also considered the issue. See references 96-122. Kip and I divided up the work and chose the provocative title, Gravitational Wave Astronomy. Gravitational waves were not yet known to exist, much less to be of any use to astronomers. Kip was to be in charge of the section on astrophysical sources, which he parsed in his typically careful way as A. sources known to exist, B. sources that probably exist, and C. sources that might exist. However, even the first category was highly speculative. I was in charge of everything else, including the scholarly apparatus of locating and cataloging all the relevant papers, similar in spirit to stamp or coin collecting. In those days before citation databases and before the web, one proceeded by gathering all the recent relevant papers one could find, then, in the physics library journal stacks, looking up all of their earlier references, then all the references in those, and so on, until the set of relevant references closed on itself. While tedious mechanically, every relevant reference had to be hand-copied onto a 3x5 card, I had a good time tracing ideas backwards in time, and in doing so, learning bits of science. I spent long, happy days in the physics stacks. A few weeks later, I was ready to begin writing. Kip summoned me to his office one morning, saying that he wanted to talk to me about my future. I could tell when I walked in that it was not going to be just happy talk. He was being pressured from several directions to award me my PhD immediately, he said, and he didn't think that I was ready. John Wheeler was soon going to offer me a postdoctoral position at Princeton for next year. Kip wanted me to turn it down after George Trilling close to offered me the assistant professorship at Berkeley, several Caltech faculty. He mentioned Peter Goldreich and Jesse Greenstein, but I surmised also Tombrello, Gunn, and maybe even Feynman, wanted Caltech to match that offer. It would be controversial because there was an explicit policy that the department not hire its own graduating students. Kip felt that I needed at least a year more maturing and that he would be caught in the middle, expected to support his own student, but not, he told me, wanting to. I had the potential, he told me, to become one of the world's top astrophysicists. I was smarter than he was, smarter than the rest of his students, but by contrast with him and them, I was lazy. I wasn't motivated. He wanted to help launch my brilliant career, but only if I would agree to change and become motivated. He continued. He had been watching me closely. I was always talking about the TV series that Margaret and I watched regularly, and he had made a point of watching some of them. They were all unworthy. He was particularly appalled by the show O'Hara, U.S. Treasury Agent. In my opinion, this was a truly great show. Every week O'Hara was assigned to a different sub-agency within U.S. Treasury, Secret Service, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Internal Revenue, and so on. The only constant was that, at the end of every episode, when he was about to make the arrest, even the meekest suspect would unexpectedly draw a gun. O'Hara, played by David Janssen, would then draw his own weapon and shout, "O'Hara, U.S. Treasury Agent, stop or I'll shoot," and then shoot the suspect dead, saving the U.S. Treasury the cost of a prosecution and trial. Margaret and I particularly liked it when the now-dead suspect was guilty of a crime like income tax evasion or failure to purchase required liquor excise stamps. Kip estimated that I actually worked on my research about 3 hours a day. I objected. I thought it was 3 hours a day for 9 months of the year, but 16 hours a day for the 3 months in total that I might have my teeth sunk into a good problem. That's just it, he said in frustration. The proportions ought to be the reverse. A good scientist could have at most one outside interest. His was sex, he said with a completely straight face. If mine was TV, he could accept that. But no, TV was just one of many other competing interests for me. That wasn't all. He was appalled at how little I knew about thermodynamics and hydrodynamics. He was right about that. Neither had been part of Harvard's undergraduate physics curriculum. It was left that I agreed to try to work harder, and he assigned me to calculate the adiabatic accretion of gas onto a spherical black hole. It was a straightforward computer calculation that would require me to learn some thermodynamics and hydrodynamics. I didn't think that it would lead to anything interesting. Spoiler alert, it didn't. We submitted our review paper, Gravitational Wave Astronomy, to Annual Review at the beginning of February. It was published in September 1972. After that time, I never again worked on gravitational waves, their production by astrophysical sources, or their possible detection. Since Kip's and my stories must presently diverge, let me jump out of narrative time on just this subject. Kip was slow to give up completely on Weber's observations, and he never gave up hope for the detection of gravitational waves. That, along with the properties of black holes, became the defining centerline of his career for the next 40 years, with most of his more than 50 PhD students, he counted me as number 9, doing their PhD theses on those subjects. Kip was instrumental in convincing Caltech to hire the Scottish experimental physicist Ron Drever, who began an experimental effort based on laser interferometry. Starting around 1980, this effort joined forces with that of Rainer Weiss at MIT and became the National Science Foundation-funded LIGO project, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. The idea was to use high-precision lasers to monitor the distance between two mirrors suspended many kilometers apart. A passing gravitational wave would alter that distance by a tiny fraction of the size of one proton. It took 20 years for the two LIGO observing stations in Washington State and Louisiana to be built and brought into operation. They observed for 8 years, from 2002 to 2010, and saw nothing. Most billion-dollar-level experiments would have been terminated at that point, but due in large part to Kip's continuing evangelism, the NSF funded Enhanced LIGO, and after that, Advanced LIGO. As a Harvard professor, I was often a reviewer of the LIGO proposals to NSF. I always gave enthusiastically positive reviews. This was not due to loyalty to Kip. In truth, I never expected LIGO to find gravitational waves. What I liked and supported was the technology development. The LIGO team, which grew to many hundreds of people, were pushing the frontiers of subatomic measurement by many orders of magnitude, far into the quantum domain. This was truly basic research, worth doing for its own sake. At 9:54 C on the 14th of September 2015, LIGO detected the unmistakable gravitational wave signature of two black holes, each of mass 30 times that of the Sun, spiraling together and merging. Prior to this detection, no one thought that black holes of this mass even existed. None of Kip's likeliness categories, A, B, or C, in our 1972 review had contemplated 30 solar mass black holes. The idea was too outlandish. In 2017, Kip, by then age 77, along with Rye Weiss and Barry Barish, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. Back to 1972, where I was struggling with the younger Kip's tough love. It was a no-brainer that I had to appear to be working harder than before, at least until I got my degree. But did I really want the kind of future that Kip laid out for me, 16-hour days with timeouts only for TV or sex, and I could only choose one? I didn't. I didn't have the driving ambition that Kip, or my father, or Saul, for that matter, had. Perhaps my lack of drive came from being in Frank's shadow, the way Tommy Lauritsen had been in Charlie's. If so, I thought of it as a blessing. I didn't need to be a slave to ambition. I did what I was doing because it was fun. What I liked was learning, knowing, and discovering. It didn't matter how serious or unserious the subject was. It was curiosity, pure and simple. I had tasted the feeling of being the first to discover something with black hole vibrations. That was a feeling that I wanted more of, but not because of any expectation that it would advance my career. Margaret and I invited Kip and Linda to dinner at our house. We made a point of showing them my workbench with locksmithing and electronics parts strewn about, her floor loom, the piano, the wind-up phonograph, the box full of tetrahedrons made out of plastic soda straws that had at various times been assembled as a 12-foot-high replica of a Dyson sphere. This was supposed to be a gentle pushback against Kip's narrow vision of my future. He didn't appear to get the message. The next week, Kip was pleased to see me still working at 6 o'clock. He took the occasion to tell me that the department had agreed to hold for me its prestigious postdoctoral title, Richard Chase Tolman Fellow. I could become a postdoc with that title whenever I finished my thesis. "When will that be?" I asked. "As early as next autumn, or as late as never," he said a bit testily. "It's up to you." Thus continued his plan to motivate me. When I complained to Kip that Jim Bardeen had completely stalled on providing a first draft of the follow-up paper to our first one, he told me to fly to Seattle and do whatever it took to extract a paper out of him. I didn't know that co-authorship worked that way, but I was on a plane in 36 hours. Jim and Nancy put me up in their modest home. The first day, in his office, Jim was, for him, quite talkative about every topic in physics except our paper. At dinner, Nancy asked me what we had accomplished, and I said, "Nothing." "Then he'll have to start now," she said. She made him sit at one end of the living room sofa, me at the other end. He wrote one sentence at a time on a pad of yellow paper. It took 5 or 10 minutes, then passed me the pad. I either approved the sentence or sent it back for a rewrite. Nancy sat across the room in a chair, grimacing 50 different ways. She had a very mobile face. We continued until well after midnight. I was there for 3 days, but came back with a draft paper. Even better, I got Jim to agree to sponsor Saul for the Lesouches Summer School in France. Kip had used up his quota of influence in getting Cliff Will and me accepted. My flight home was diverted from LAX to Long Beach because of fog. By the beginning of spring, I was giving job talks, not because I was actually looking for a job yet, but because I was getting invitations that I didn't want to turn down. My physics colloquium at Caltech went well with Willie, department chair Bob Layton, Tommy Feynman, and Carl Anderson in the front row, and with my clack of Kip and the group, Jim Gunn, Virginia Trimble, and Steve Wilner, who was now a Caltech graduate student, populating the next several rows. Jim Bardeen had decided, after many months of indecision, to accept a full professorship at Yale, and he had an assistant professor position to fill there. George Trilling invited me to bring Margaret on my visit to Berkeley. We were feted and treated like grown-ups, which seemed strange to us, especially in Berkeley, where we had so recently been students being tear-gassed in People's Park. Our sudden, new protocol rank merited attendance at the dinner in our honor by not one but two Nobel Prize winners, Charlie Townes and Emilio Segre. Townes had moved to Berkeley from MIT in 1967 and now worked in radio astronomy. His presence thus made some sense. Segre seemed to be the noblest on call for social occasions, a kind of academic Duke of Plaza Toro. Segre discovered the antiproton and also two elements, technetium and astatine. He won the 1959 Nobel Prize in Physics. The Duke of Plaza Toro, in Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers, hired himself out to charity dinners in return for 10% of the proceeds. I met privately with Townes at the end of the next day. As provost at MIT, he had been the closer who recruited Frank there. Now it was Berkeley and me, two different generations, two different coasts. Townes showed off his pre-production handheld electronic calculator, the Hewlett-Packard 25. He was on the HP board, which could calculate logarithms, exponentials, sines, cosines, etc. I had never seen anything remotely like it. It was by far the highlight of the trip. A week later, I gave a talk at the University of Texas at Austin. Bryce DeWitt was my host, and I met his graduate student Larry Smarr, who will figure prominently later in my story. A few weeks after that, I was in Utah visiting Richard Price and giving the same talk. There was still a lot of snow at Alta, and Richard took me skiing for the first time since I was 14. He coached me down one real run, lectured me on the physical principles. The torsional modulus of a ski must be much larger than its longitudinal modulus, but some dissipation is necessary in the longitudinal mode, but ultimately gave up on account of my athletic ineptitude. I did several runs down the bunny slope, my appropriate level, while he did two serious runs. Freeman Dyson, the famous British-American mathematical physicist from Princeton, happened also to be visiting Salt Lake City. My colloquium dinner was merged with the much bigger dinner reception in his honor at the Fort Douglas Hidden Valley Country Club. I shook Dyson's hand. He had no idea who I was, and I didn't explain. Kip's plan to motivate me by holding my PhD hostage came to an unexpected end that April. I was working in my office on a Saturday morning. Kip was in his office, unusual for a Saturday. The building was otherwise deserted. Maybe that was what did it. After an hour, Kip sauntered by my office. "I think you should schedule the formalities and get your degree as soon as you get back from La Huche," Kip said, "so that you can be a postdoc as soon as possible." That was that. I had somehow passed the motivation test. I could go back to watching O'Hara. Chapter 23. IOTA. As the summer of 1972 approached, Saul and I had become joined at the hip professionally. This was a partnership that was to last, in one form or another, for more than half a century. We looked to Kip for support and career guidance. He was our academic father figure. But increasingly, we looked for scientific advice elsewhere. Saul developed a relationship with the applied mathematicians in Galsit, Caltech's famous engineering department. We corresponded, in those days by airmail, with Chandra, Bardeen, Misner, and a couple of Kip's former black hole students. Alan Lightman and David Lee were now holding up the other pole in Kip's group, working on other theories of gravity, meaning alternatives to general relativity, and especially how future experiments could rule them out, hopefully leaving Einstein's theory alone as viable. One of Kip's last lectures in the relativity class was on gravitational wave detection, much of it presented in exactly my review article words. Kip was truly a dyed-in-the-wool theorist. He tended to accept uncritically all statements on matters experimental by experimenters, learned these by rote, and was uncritical of their underlying assumptions. Of course, I was hardly without sin in claiming to have experimental expertise when I could barely hold a screwdriver. But still, at the time, I was the more experimental of us two. Saul and I were turning out serviceable scientific papers, well beyond what was expected of graduate students, but in no way revolutionary. Although Chandra had left, Bonnie Miller was still around. There were natural extensions of her thesis work on gravitating ellipsoidal bodies that between Saul's ability at math and mine at computing, we could easily do. We tried to include Bonnie in the work, and we would have made her a co-author regardless, but she insisted on withdrawing, even though she had no job offers and badly needed more publications. Even Kip couldn't convince her otherwise. Bonnie's problem was that she was too honest, too nuanced as a person, and not greedy enough as a scientist. Separately, Saul and I were cranking out every possible calculation that could be done for scalar fields interacting with Kerr black holes. Unfortunately, with no actual scalar fields existing in nature, these were calculations that impressed only the black hole cognoscenti. On a Friday in early June, several of us joined Kip and Feynman at lunch in the Greasy. Kip ate hurriedly and went off to an appointment, but Feynman was enjoying a leisurely conversational pace. Talk was about the lack of progress in particle theory, that most fundamental branch of physics, his own field. "I'll tell you what I notice most," he said. "I'm 54 years old, and I'm still doing better work than the young men, sick, in the field." He drew the contrast to previous times when the advances in physics were made by the younger or youngest people. I said to him, "Suppose you were the czar of theoretical physics with the power to tell anyone what directions to pursue. How long would it take to explain everything, to understand the fundamental nature of the elementary particles?" "2 years," he said, without hesitation. "And how long will it take with the field's current crop of researchers? Maybe forever." Every generation sees the next as not as good as its own, but Feynman's pessimism was not well-founded. The stagnation of particle physics in the early 1970s would soon be replaced by a so-called standard model that didn't explain everything, but did explain, very elegantly, most things. Most of the elements of the Standard Model were already known at the time of the above conversation: Yang-Mills theory, Glashow's unified electroweak theory, Weinberg and Salam's version of the Higgs mechanism, asymptotic freedom. I had learned about most of these in Feynman's course the year before. What needed to change was more about forgetting than discovering. Quarks were not vague manifestations of some Gell-Mann-esque symmetry principle or S-matrix breakdown of space and time. Forget that. They were real, if unfamiliar, particles that carried conserved quantities, electric charge, strangeness, and color. Unfortunate names, and obeyed a version of the Yang-Mills equation soon known as quantum chromodynamics, QCD, by analogy with the equations of quantum electrodynamics, QED, that had won Feynman his Nobel. Most particles were composites of quarks, just as atoms were composites of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Instead of being bound by electromagnetic forces, the virtual photons that bound the electrons in atoms, quarks were bound together by strongly interacting gluons. The 1983 experimental discovery of the W and Z bosons with just the masses predicted by QCD convinced almost everyone. Feynman, who died at age 69 in 1988 of a rare liposarcoma, lived to see these changes. Three of us in Kip's group had gained admission to Cecile DeWitt's physics summer school in the French Alps: Cliff, Will, Saul, and me. That summer's topic would be black holes. Kip was a lecturer. We were all bringing our wives. Cliff was married to Leslie, Kip's secretary. The school had dorm accommodations for unaccompanied attendees, and Cecile grudgingly agreed to let Linda stay with Kip in an apartment reserved for lecturers. But when we telephoned her in Texas, she rejected, with a Gallic gesture that we could almost hear, the idea of accommodating the wives of students. She referred us to the Hotel Peter Pan, a tiny place about halfway down the mountain slope from the school toward the actual town of Les Houches. We wrote to the hotel, in French, of course. Cliff was Canadian, and Saul had taken lessons at the Alliance Française in Johannesburg, and received an answer 3 weeks later. L'hôtel est complet, fully booked. We telephoned Cecile, who was this time slightly more helpful. There was a local landowner, a Monsieur Laprade, who owned an unoccupied farmhouse a kilometer up the mountain from the school. We should write to his adult daughter and ask to rent it. Cecile provided an address. 2 weeks later, success. But with the proviso that, once we arrived, the father would want to interview us and might still reject us as tenants. The daughter provided one hint. Her father, age 89, was a great admirer of Napoleon and might ask us for our views on that subject. Apparently still a matter of lively debate in the Haute Savoie. The summer school was scheduled for August. Martin Rees invited me to spend July in Cambridge, England, at IOTA, the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy. I was one grain of sand in a sandbox of academic political intrigue. IOTA was Fred Hoyle's institute, founded by him just 5 years earlier and housed in a modern one-story building on Mattingly Road, adjacent to a sheep pasture. If the building seemed more California than East Anglia, it was because it was a copy of a building at UC San Diego that Fred had admired. Recently, Cambridge University had decided to merge IOTA with its astronomy department and observatory into a single Institute of Astronomy. Fred had agreed, but on condition that the new director be an observer, not a theorist, so that the old IOTA would be left essentially untouched as a center for theory under his direction. For the new director, Fred favored Caltech professor Wal Sargent, who was a Brit. Instead, the university named Donald Lyndon Bell, a theorist. Lyndon Bell was a man of charming enthusiasm and right-wing political views. He had been on sabbatical at Caltech my first year there, and I took his astronomy course. In response to Lyndon Bell's appointment, Fred, who had just been knighted and was now Sir Fred, resigned his Plumian professorship, a chair founded by Isaac Newton, and threatened to resign from the university entirely, a bluff which, when called the next year, did force him to leave Cambridge for Manchester. There was an effort in the summer of 1972 to show the world that IOTA was not falling apart, although it was. Thus, more than the usual number of summer visitors were invited, including me. Martin Rees was at the time just 5 years past his PhD. When Sir Fred left Cambridge, Martin was rusticated in Sussex for a year, then returned to Cambridge as the new Plumian professor and new director of IOTA. Margaret and I were already packing for the trip when I went to work on Monday, June 12, 1972. I found Saul in his office and handed him the ellipsoid paper draft to read. Roz was with him. Saul said to me, "I separated the gravitational perturbation equation for Kerr last night." Separate, pronounced separate, is a term of art in partial differential equations. The meaning here was that instead of a set of 45 coupled equations involving all the space coordinates simultaneously, a mess then too hard to solve by computer, Saul had found a way to separate out a single equation, easy to compute, from which the full solution could, if desired, be calculated. His equation would soon be known as the Tucholsky equation. I could hardly believe it. If true, it was the most important discovery in black hole theory in several years. He had worked it out twice last night, then slept on it. "He was up at 7:15 this morning," Roz said, in awe of the early hour. It had also worked this morning, and here we were. Saul had called Kip to tell him just before I got there. Could the same trick be used to separate the electromagnetic equation which Ipser and Fackerel had spent months working on and failed? Saul started calculating. By lunchtime, he had the answer. Yes. We spent the afternoon discussing all the different problems that were now amenable to solution. No longer would we have to say that we had solved such and such a problem with a fictitious scalar field because the gravitational case was too hard. Kip met with us to discuss how Saul should publish his result. If it went to a fast journal, like Physical Review Letters, then Saul would be famous faster, but the equation would be in the public domain. We would have to race everyone else to milk its applications. Kip favored submitting it to a slower journal, like the Astrophysical Journal. Saul's priority would be guaranteed by the submission date. We could let the fact of Saul's success, but not the equation itself, leak out gradually. We would have a good 6 months to be ahead of everyone else. I pointed out that Kip had always before favored the prompt, free exchange of scientific ideas. "This is just too important for that," he said. Margaret and I flew to England by student charter flight from Oakland. We could not afford her trip at regular airfares. Britain, in 1972, before Mrs. Thatcher, before the North Sea oil, before the European Union, before London had become the world financial center, before the arrival of decent cuisine, was a poor country. Average incomes were less than half those of the U.S. IOTA had arranged housing that they thought suitable for married students. It turned out to be a disconnected tiny sitting room, an even smaller bedroom, a hot plate, no refrigerator, and a bathroom two flights down shared with six other people. We threw ourselves on Martin's mercy. He put in a good word with the bursar's office at King's, his college, and we were soon installed in a tiny but fully adequate flat on Bennett Street, just a block from the market square in the city center. Rent was £10 a week. Margaret successfully navigated the bureaucratic labyrinth of getting gas and electricity turned on. We both soon learned the secret of impoverished English life. Choices, when offered, were tempting, but illusory. In any situation, there was a done thing. All other seeming options were either unavailable, fiercely expensive, or considered to be in poor taste. You could ask what the done thing was, and you should then immediately choose it. Daily life became much easier after that. We enjoyed the peculiarities. You couldn't buy milk, except preserved milk, in the not very supermarket. Instead, the done thing was to take an empty milk bottle from outside your neighbor's door and place it outside your own door. The next morning, an invisible milkman would have replaced it with an unrefrigerated full bottle, no questions asked. If you wanted two bottles delivered, you put out two empties. If you wanted a newspaper delivered to your door, you mentioned it to the man selling newspapers at the nearest street newsstand. Which paper will you be wanting? What is the done thing? The Guardian started appearing at our door. We were students, of course. We even managed to rent a television for the month, for £5. The done thing, according to the rental store proprietor, was not to buy the required expensive television license. Instead, if the TV inspector ever appeared at our door, we should resort to delaying tactics. We never found out exactly what these were. We treated ourselves to one anomaly, a not done thing. Our first morning in Cambridge, we had wandered into the Blue Boar, Cambridge's fanciest hotel, desperate for breakfast. This was not a done thing. Breakfast was served only to hotel residents. We must have looked so American, so young, and so pitiable that they made an exception. We could have their elaborate, full English breakfast for 60 pence, a price that they invented on the spot, about $1.50. We went back every day for the whole month we were there. Margaret always wore a nice dress so that we wouldn't too much lower the tone of the place. The Cambridge-Caltech connection was strong. Willie Fowler, Jim Gunn, and Wall Sargent were all visiting that summer, a show of solidarity for the beleaguered Sir Fred. Others whom I talked to regularly were Martin, Brandon Carter, Stephen Hawking, Gary Gibbons, Jacqueline Bergeron, and my office mate, Max Crook, a senior Harvard professor whose applied math course I had once audited. Hawking was based at DAMTP, Cambridge's legendary Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics, and, although mostly confined to a wheelchair, he could drive a little electric car with special controls and often spent mornings at IOTA. He was interested in hearing about Sol's equation and gave me oral messages to convey back to Sol by post, things like, the Newman-Penrose spin coefficients should vanish on the horizon. The Institute was famous, especially summers, for its atmosphere of relaxed discussion. I spent hours discussing physics and astronomy, sometimes politics, with each of those already mentioned, including the Caltech professors, previously unapproachable on their home turf. Lunches were often at pubs in the countryside around Cambridge, Mattingly, and Coton, invariably with a half pint of room-temperature bitter, the done thing. At one lunch, I launched into an impromptu lecture on the implications of the Hawking-Penrose-Gibbons global theorems about black holes. Stephen was sitting next to me. He seemed neither pleased nor displeased, but at least didn't correct me. The British relativists understood, a bit jealously, that armed with our still-secret equation, Sol and I would be first to prove that Kerr black holes were actually stable, or even better, find that they weren't, probably in the early fall. Still, it was a race of sorts. The following Wednesday, at morning coffee at the Institute, a crowd was gathered around the table where Sir Fred was holding forth on his analysis of Bobby Fischer's position in chess. Donald Lyndon Bell came in and stood alone at a corner of the room. It was not clear whether he was being snubbed intentionally or whether no one dared be the first to desert Fred's camp. But 10 minutes later, Donald was still standing by himself in the same spot. My allegiance was to neither side, so I wandered over to chat with this controversial new director. I introduced myself as a student of Kipps, and we talked about current work in black holes. A few minutes later, Martin Rees also joined us. Lyndon Bell was either a brave man, I thought, or else much more arrogant at heart than his manner indicated. His appointment and Fred's impending departure were widely perceived as damaging to the Institute, if not the whole university. Margaret and I did in fact manage to avoid taking sides. Despite my approach to Lyndon Bell, we were soon invited to tea at the Hoyles, along with Willie and Artie, and Don Clayton, another visiting American. Clayton was Willie's former student. His was the textbook for the course at Harvard, where we students tortured the poor, green Dick McRae. Clayton's later 1975 popular book, The Dark Night Sky, a personal adventure in cosmology, was so full of himself that it became known among astrophysicists as The Universe and Me, not necessarily in that order. Now, we watched on TV as Stan Smith, my high school classmate, as it improbably happened, defeated Ilya Nastase at Wimbledon. A different evening, Martin insisted that we come to dinner with him, Joe Weber, and Virginia Trimble. Unsaid was the reason. Martin and Virginia had been an item in the past, everyone knew, and he felt uncomfortable with just her and her new, much older husband. We came prepared to carry the conversational ball, but Virginia easily outdid us. Yet another evening, we had dinner with Jim and Rosemary Gunn and Lyndon Bell. Donald was the opposite of Fred in every way, including being a Tory of the far right. His perspective was that IOTA had it too soft, that the university had coddled Fred, and that the new IOA would act in the interests of Cambridge University rather than Fred's international claque, by whom he especially meant Willie Fowler, Wall Sargent, and the rest of the Caltech crowd. One afternoon, at tea, I was talking to Stephen about some technical details of the Kerr stability problem. He seemed quite interested. He invited me back to his office and had me shut the door. After about 2 minutes more of talk, he said, "Can you help me to the toilet?" It was exactly Bryce DeWitt's story about Paul Dirac, but now brought up to date with a more modern Cambridge physicist. I wondered how many other stories were in circulation about great physicists who needed to pee. As the end of the month approached, we loaded up on books from Heffer's bookshop and shipped them by sea mail back to Pasadena. On the last Saturday in July, by taxi, train, and bus, we wrestled our luggage to Heathrow. The flight to Geneva was an hour and a quarter. From there, a taxi to the bus station, and we bought tickets for the bus to La Huche, with a 2.5 hour wait until the next bus. We sat in a well-manicured park, reading and eating Swiss chocolate. Geneva was beautiful, clean, and modern, but it was francophone, one strike against it for me. The bus departed at 5:30 p.m., crossed into France without any inspection of passports or luggage, and wound its way up into the Alps. At 7:30 p.m., the driver let us off in tiny La Huche. A middle-aged lady came out of a shop, sized us up as École d'été de physique, and waved to the lone taxi driver parked up the street. 20 minutes later, we walked into the school's empty dining room. Not quite empty. In one corner, Bryce and Cecile and Saul and Roz were just starting dinner. We all were the earliest arrivals. Saul had already seen our rented house. "It was very impressive," he said, "very peculiar, and very, very far up the mountain with no road." After dinner, we four, with the press family's luggage, began the trek, scrambling with 50-pound suitcases up steep, rocky trails in the dark. 10 rest stops, and 45 minutes later, we approached the dark, rambling silhouette, all logs and rough-hewn boards, with doors no more than 4 feet high. It was as if from a museum exhibit. The house was built in 1777 as a tight, alpine farmhouse chalet, designed to be snowed in for the long winters. The main beam of the house was carved with Fête le 13 May, 1777, followed by the initials of the whole family of original occupants, a cross, and a wheel to ward off the devil. Stooping through the front door, one was in the high-ceilinged great room, like the main hall of some Viking manor, a huge fireplace dominating. Livestock, as well as people, would have been sheltered in this room during the coldest weather. A balcony at second floor level surrounded the great room on 3 sides, with bedrooms off the balcony. Back at ground level, another 4-foot door led to a dining room and a kitchen with a wood-burning stove. There were electric lights in every room, but the voltage was low, so they glowed only feebly, like candles. The locals believed, according to Cecile, that electricity had weight and had a difficult time making it up the steep mountain. A better theory was that the gauge of the wires on the utility poles was insufficient, or that they might be iron instead of copper. Our original plan had been to share the cost among 3 couples, including the Wills. However, back in Pasadena, Leslie Will and I had gotten into a tiff over something that seemed important at the time. Kip gave both of us a dressing down, and the Wills had withdrawn from the partnership. As school participants arrived on Sunday, Cecile introduced us to Gideon Rakavi and his wife Ina, both in their 40s. He was a professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. "Of course, it's none of my responsibility," Cecile said. This remark habitually prefaced her every command. "But you may want to take the Rakavis into your house. They have no other accommodations." So we all helped Gideon and Ina, too, carry their overweight luggage up the mountain. On one of our first daytime marches up the hill to our chalet, we encountered an old man, quintessentially French in appearance, with a white beret, carved walking stick, pantaloon trousers, gray wool socks, and walking shoes. "Êtes-vous Monsieur Laprade?" "Oui." We identified ourselves as his tenants. He asked where we were from. Saul's answer made an impression on him. "Sud Afrique," he repeated, nodding knowingly. After some polite conversation, we continued our separate ways. The next day, Saul and I hiked up the hill beyond our house to M. Laprade's chalet. Cecile had given us directions. "We are here to pay the rent," we announced. He invited us into his study, seated us, and puttered behind his desk, filling the inkwell to dip his steel pen. Another 15 minutes of polite conversation. He asked where we were from. "Sud Afrique," seemed to ring a bell whose sound he couldn't place. He explained that his daughter, who was to arrive in 2 weeks, handled all the arrangements. Therefore, we could pay him any amount we want. He would write us un petit reçu, and then his daughter, Maman Bar, would straighten things out. I paid the full amount, minus the deposit that we had already paid and that the Rakavis had paid, 900 francs in all. He signed the receipt in a spidery hand. As we were leaving, the memory of Sudafrique finally clicked in his mind. Did I talk to you yesterday? We next saw M. Laprade when he called at our house, took us outside and pointed to the grenier. A grenier, literally granary, was a separate tiny house, windowless, unheated, tightly constructed, that was built on a raised platform some distance from the main house. It was for storing the winter's supply of grain for eating, plus seed for the spring planting. It was separated from the house so that if the house caught fire, the family would not then starve. C'est une petite maison historique, he said. The royal family of Belgium lived in it during the war, hiding from the Germans. Which war? We asked, especially since our house was full of pictures and engravings of Napoleon. His lengthy reply proved to be beyond our language abilities. More than a week after we were in the house, we discovered that Princeton graduate student Baylock Hu and his wife were living in our grenier, which was fitted out as a tiny windowless bedroom. It seems that Cecile had negotiated a side arrangement with M. Laprade to rent the grenier separately. There was no toilet. Baylock had been carrying a chamber pot down the mountain to empty at the school. Once we discovered him, we let him use our toilet instead, but preferably when we weren't home. Later, Ina Rockavy established excellent relations with Laprade. She was educated in France and spoke the language fluently. Also, she happened to be a student of architecture, and she knew of Laprade's famous work. In the French colonization of Morocco after the First World War, he was the leading architectural influence. Indeed, Albert Laprade was a celebrated French architect whose career spanned the decades 1910 to 1960. Who could have guessed? I'll jump out of time with a much later story about Gideon Rakavy. In the 1990s, I was sitting in my office at Harvard chewing the fat with an Israeli scientist who enjoyed gossip almost as much as I did. On this occasion, she was listing for me all of her colleagues in the Raqqa Institute at Hebrew University who, in her opinion, were unproductive deadwood. She thought they should be retired, if not shot. She was a person who carried her emotions close to the surface. Well, what about Rakavi? I asked, mentioning that had I shared a house with him at Les Houches in 1972 and had never subsequently seen a single published paper with his name on it. No, I don't count him, she said. He and his group work on the atomic bomb project, and supposedly they do good work. What? I said. Then, as now, Israel had no publicly acknowledged nuclear weapons program. Until that moment, I had never actually seen someone's face turn pale white. The exact physiological opposite of a blush. Oh my God. After a pause, she said, I thought we were in Israel. I forgot that you are an American. Chapter 24. Les Houches. We adjusted to the physics school's daily routine. Margaret and I woke up every morning under several quilts to the sound of oversized alpine cowbells, the kind shown on postcards. A neighbor's herd was driven past our house on its way to daily greener pastures. I threw open the shutters to the brilliant view of the steeply rising green meadow, wildflowers, alpine backdrop, very Heidi pretty. The Rakavis, whose bedroom was downstairs, were always up much earlier. There was a sink upstairs, accessible from both the Tucholskys and our bedrooms. Margaret and I had first use, then we knocked on the other door to be sure that Saul and Roz were up. Half an hour later, we four emerged into the sunlight and walked down to breakfast. The walk was 12 minutes downhill in the morning, 18 minutes uphill at night, including a four-minute rest on La Prade's bench. Breakfast was served in the restaurant, as the school's dining room was called, from 8 to 9. Baguette with butter, never the croissants and rolls that could be bought in the village, café, thé, or chocolat. We always asked for refills on the late show, which we strained through our own precious tea strainer, purchased in Chamonix. Only after dinner was the hot milk properly steamed on the espresso machine instead of being boiled. The restaurant was run by Hung Ri, who was the husband of Nicole, the school's secretary. He was also an alpine guide and a local property owner. The chef's father was the village taxi driver, and the serving girls were related to everybody. We paid for the meals with little tickets, except that when the supply of printed tickets ran out, cash suddenly became acceptable. The first lecture began at 9, later for lazy lecturers, and ended between 10:30 and 11. Margaret and Roz, usually with Leslie Will and Betsy, age 8, took over the lounge at one end of the building. A small scientific library was at the other end. Between the two morning lectures was a half-hour tea break. Lunch was the best meal of the day. The restaurant staff was always very friendly, and one's ability to obtain substitutions, but never extra servings of meat, was limited only by one's ability to communicate in French. There were Gallic idiosyncrasies. The meals served one course at a time, the vegetables after the meat, the salad at the very end, with a superfluity of yogurt, never anything else, for dessert. When there was an afternoon lecture, about half the time, it began at 5. The earlier afternoon was reserved for less formal seminars, conversation, hiking, which we avoided, trips into Chamonix to buy the International Herald Tribune, or, as seemed to be our default option, sitting in the lounge passing time. A shifting alliance of presses, Tucholskys, Wills, and Thorns soon claimed exclusive title to the lounge, in later weeks joined by Lane Houston, a Rhodes Scholar and student of Roger Penrose, and various of his Anglo-American friends. People accommodated nearer the school hung out in their rooms, but we were not keen to hike up our mountain more than once a day. Dinner was at 7:30. The kitchen staff worked long hours and were the same at all meals. Above the dining room was a balcony where coffee was taken after the meal. For us, according to the formula, petit café dans une grande tasse avec beaucoup de lait chaud, soon abbreviated to comme toujours. Typically, we spent a couple of hours after dinner talking or playing cards or reading in our lounge before walking up the mountain. The lights in our farmhouse were too dim for comfortable reading. The Rakavis were usually there before us. Gideon was a master fire builder, and they were often sitting in the dark main room staring at a mountain of glowing coals in the massive fireplace, open on all four sides. Saul or I lit the wood-burning hot water heater so that we would have hot water in the morning. We all went to bed before midnight. The lecturers included Kip, Jim Bardeen, and Bryce DeWitt from the U.S., Stephen Hawking and Brandon Carter from the U.K., Marek Demiansky from Poland, Igor Novikov from Moscow, and Remo Ruffini, who gave lectures that were so transparently full of himself that attendance fell to near zero after the first, to my great satisfaction. I had never forgiven Remo for forcing himself onto my paper with Richard Price. Hawking was exceptionally well prepared and passed out detailed lecture notes in advance of each lecture. His labored speech was difficult for the English speakers to understand, impossible for the others. Stephen mentioned in passing several results of Saul's and mine, but without ever mentioning our names. It was an early hint of what became obvious later in Stephen's career that he was exceptionally frugal in giving credit of any kind to others. Nancy Bardeen sat with us at dinner one Saturday night when Jim was not yet back from mountain climbing. "What is Jim lecturing about?" she asked us. "Haven't you asked him?" I responded. She looked at me as if I should know better. She told us that Jim frequently dreamt that he had told her things, or that he had had long conversations with her. In his dream world, apparently, he was a fluent, talkative person. "Well," she said, perking up a bit, "I'd rather have someone silent who occasionally says important things than someone who just chatters all the time." "Oh, Bill just chatters all the time," Margaret interjected helpfully. One afternoon, Cecile summoned me secretly to her office. She had insider information, she said, that I would be invited to the prestigious Copernicus Conference in Poland next year, a convocation honoring the 500th anniversary of Copernicus's birth. Saul was not on the invitation list, but now that Demiansky had met and heard him here, he hoped to have him invited too. It would depend on how many people didn't accept. But it turned out that this was all merely a preface to the true business at hand. Because of currency restrictions, Demiansky was unable to bring from behind the Iron Curtain funds enough for his expenses here this summer. Cecile was making up the difference, but only temporarily. She needed a trusted party. By that she meant someone bent, actually, whose expenses in Poland would be paid by the Poles on condition that he remit to Cecile an equivalent amount in dollars, obtained, presumably by turning in a false expense account to Caltech. For some reason, she had decided that I was her man. It was another typical Cecile project, especially since it was none of her responsibility. "Of course, I'll make it slightly worth your while," she said, with the emphasis on slightly. An after-dinner gathering in the Hawkings flat was an affair of studied normality. Jane Hawking was a pretty hostess, serving hot mulled wine and engaging in conversation with each group of guests in turn. Stephen had labored conversations with a few groups. Margaret and I chatted with Stephen's parents, who were visiting. Mrs. Hawking, Sr., was very English in that London, educated sort of way. In the school restaurant, she expected the serving girls to speak English, but she permitted daughter-in-law Jane to translate to French when they could not understand her. Stephen's 16-year-old brother was with them. He was a muscular fellow who gulped down his food and then excused himself. His mother told us that he had just failed his O-level examinations and didn't want to do anything in life except become a professional football player and get married. "To anyone in particular?" I asked. "It's always someone in particular, but the someone changes from time to time. He always wants to do the right thing by them." She wore the facade of being oblivious to Stephen's condition, but there was an instant when she was laboriously helping him to eat a piece of cheese that the mask seemed to drop, but she quickly recovered. Towards the end of the month, the simple pleasures of rustic life and black holes were beginning to cloy, particularly with the same company day in and day out. Our inner sphere of 8 or 10 people, now often including Bryce DeWitt's student Larry Smarr, revolved in a larger constellation of 20 or so, mostly the Americans. Add 10 wandering comets with whom we had passing exchange, and finally 20 or so people whom we hardly knew, many of the Europeans and a few camp followers around Ramo. Same faces at dinner, in the lectures, passed with nodding hellos in the school buildings, in the village of Les Houches, even on every block in Chamonix, a town of a few thousand people, 10 kilometers up the valley. Les Houches itself boasted a population of a couple of hundred. A day's excitement for us might be Margaret being allowed to pay an extra half franc to secure an unlimited supply of hot steamed milk, her great sybaritic joy. For others at the school, the excitement was more likely hiking the approaches to Mont Blanc. I was jealous of the people, including Kip, who were busy on their own work, but there was not much work I could do until I got back to my computers. I busied myself writing an outline of my thesis. The thesis would be mostly an unorganized collection of my papers, per Kip's instructions, but I wanted to also include a few dozen pages of explanatory material that would tie it all together. Then soon enough, we were back in Pasadena. There, the news was not good. Tommy Lauritsen's cancer had recurred and metastasized. His condition was now thought to be terminal. He was 57. A succession of family friends began to arrive in town on what were transparently goodbye visits, but always with some other pretext. Margaret and I were often summoned to family dinners of strained bonhomie and always heavy drinking. Willie Fowler was a frequent presence. He was devoted to Tommy. When the out-of-town visitors were Fred and Barbara Hoyle, Willie and Fred drunkenly lamented the sad state of the world. They planned to retire, together, to the family farm. In their minds, there was a single farm, a rose-tinted commingling of Ohio and Yorkshire. By the time of my thesis exam in October, I had assistant professor offers from Berkeley, Yale, Utah, Harvard, and Princeton, but not the offer that I cared most about, namely one from Caltech. Kip waxed and waned with the moon in his assessment of whether I would get such an offer. I couldn't tell whether the varying factor was the department's enthusiasm or his own. Harvard's offer was the most peculiar. I got a letter from Paul Martin, the physics department chair, offering me an assistant professor position almost offhandedly, and mentioning that the only information that they had about me was my undergraduate transcript. Could I please send them something more current? This was, of course, Ed Purcell's doing. His standing at Harvard was such that his merely suggesting my name was sufficient for the department to vote an offer, without any other information or supporting materials. "You're Bill Press," Feynman said to me, sitting down with us at lunch in the Greasy. "I was reading you last night." He meant my thesis. My exam was 2 days away. Dick complained amiably about its cut-and-paste nature. "It's all right," he said, "to write a paper with mistakes, and then write a second paper correcting the first." He was a little dubious about then writing a third paper, adding rigor to the second paper's corrections of the first. He was describing my three papers with Bardeen. But he couldn't accept that I should then get to count all three as part of my thesis. Also, my earlier papers said that the gravitational equation is not separable, while my later papers say that Tucholsky separated it. I could tell that Tucholsky, not you, is the real master. Who is that guy anyway? I silently pointed to Saul, sitting next to me. My examining committee was Thorne, Feynman, and Gunn. Feynman asked 95% of the questions, mostly demanding physical, not mathematical, interpretations of things. Then he played devil's advocate and pushed to see if I could really defend my position. The couple of times I wandered off into nonsense, Kip stepped in to ask softball leading questions. It lasted 2 hours, which was shorter than average. The committee deliberated in private for about 2 minutes. "Well," Kip said jokingly when they called me back in, "you've squeaked by." Feynman interrupted gravely, "You shouldn't allow any possibility of misunderstanding in this. You should tell him that he did a good job." This was better than the Dick Feynman B I got from him when I took his course a little more than a year previously. For my party at Kip and Linda's house, Margaret and I supplied 3 gallons of Gallo jug wine, 3 quarts of cheap brandy for alcoholic punch, 1 pound of lox, 2 pounds of cream cheese, 18 bagels, 1 pound each of roast beef and pastrami, 2 pounds of pickles, and that was just the part of our list that we bought at Fedco. I had posted notices of the party in Kellogg Lab and Astronomy, and the turnout was about 75 people. The punch hid the alcohol well, and there was also a keg of beer. Everyone in Kip's group was there, including visiting Charlie Misner, and a good fraction of the Kellogg and Astro faculty. I didn't pass out, and we got home around 3. I was now Dr. Press, Caltech's Richard Chase Tolman Research Fellow in Theoretical Physics. I sent a letter to the Hertz Foundation, thanking them and resigning my remaining graduate fellowship. Chapter 25, Job, No Job. In late October 1972, Margaret and I made a trip to the places back east where I had job offers. We flew to Boston, visited my parents and sister, and then drove the 6 hours to Princeton. John Wheeler had arranged for us to stay at Palmer House, the official university guest house. We picked up a key at the university police station. We were alone in the 18-room house. The sound of a dozen ticking clocks echoed in empty hallways. Within about 3 minutes on both sides of every hour, various clocks struck inconsistent numbers of times, only some had been reset from daylight savings time. We went to dinner at the Wheeler's house, elegant, modern, on university-owned land. Mrs. Wheeler, Jeanette, also impressed us, but not in a good way. She made no bones about her distaste for Margaret's career aspirations. "When I was young, I thought of working, but Johnny pointed out that I wouldn't be able to accompany him on trips, and of course, that was that." Precisely as I finished my dessert, Jeanette took Margaret to the other side of the room and sat her down for woman talk, whose purpose was to keep her from participating in my discussion with John. Almost everything Wheeler said to sell me on Princeton had the reverse effect. "I should come," he suggested, "to bask in the reflected light of Princeton's great men past and present. Einstein, Wigner, Schwarzschild, Spitzer." Wheeler's own group had produced Feynman and Thorne, among others. Eventually, we did approach some substantive issues. With great delicacy but unmistakable finality, he assured me that Remo would not be renewed as an assistant professor when his term expired at the end of next year. Wheeler was fighting to get a tenured position for Carol Kuchaz, now also an assistant professor. If Kuchaz left, whom would he replace him with? "If he leaves, I may go tagging along after him to pick up the crumbs of his genius," he said with Wheelerian hyperbole. Kuchaz worked on so-called canonical quantum gravity, a field then in vogue, but one that subsequently produced little of significance. Palmer House was supposed to provide breakfast, but when we got up, we were still all alone in the mansion. I made my way to the physics building, Jadwin Hall. Wheeler was away on a day trip to Washington, but I had appointments with members of his relativity group, almost all of whom were leaving, some leaving with Remo, some because of him. Everyone seemed to know that Remo was being fired. When it came time for my appointment with him, he took me into his office and closed the door conspiratorially. "Certain people have stolen much of my work," he said, "but no one at Caltech." He looked forward to continuing to work with me. I wondered if by that he meant continuing to steal my work. It gradually dawned on me that Remo didn't know that he was being let go. Ed Taylor, who co-authored two excellent textbooks with John Wheeler, used to say that John had the ability to fashion a negative message from completely positive comments. That must have happened in this case. Remo heard only the positive. It was not my job to disabuse him. Jimmy York, in whom mathematical ability and southern redneck charm coexisted in an unusual mixture, was leaving for tenure at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He took me to lunch across town at the Institute for Advanced Study, where we sat at a table with Freeman Dyson, who remembered me, Tullio Reggi, and John Bachall, who was the newest IAS full professor. Bachall was formerly on the physics faculty in Kellogg Lab at Caltech. The scuttlebutt was that he didn't get along with Willie, who made his life miserable and forced him out. This was a side of jolly old Willie that I luckily had never seen. I found John refreshingly candid. "No, I wouldn't be coming to Princeton for the great men," he told me. "I would be coming because he, Jim Peebles in physics, Jerry Ostreicher in astronomy, were all talkative guys somewhat senior to me, with a reputation for collaborating." He made exactly the pitch that I wanted to hear. Over the next 20 years, John was to become my greatest mentor and cheerleader, not always with respect to the content of my work, but often in matters of how science should actually be done. I was lucky in that John had one great fault. At first meeting, he either loved you or hated you, and he never changed his mind after that. That day, he loved me, and although I didn't at the time know it, this love would in many ways guide the course of my subsequent professional life. Wheeler, back by train from Washington, took Margaret and me to dinner, again at the IAS cafeteria, a short walk from his home. We drove the 3 hours to New Haven after dinner. The Bardeens put us up in their new house, which was somewhat nicer than their house in Seattle had been. The problem for me with Yale was that the university's commitment to science was questionable, and the physics department was second rate. Their pitch was, "Come here and help Jim Bardeen make us first rate in relativity." I might have been more receptive if Jim wasn't the way he was, that is, silent, and if their new building, which was built on a shoestring budget, wasn't already visibly falling apart. Also, this far from any mountains to climb, the literal, not figurative, kind, I doubted that Jim would stay at Yale for long. Yale wasn't completely out of the running for me, but nearly so. We drove to Boston the next evening. In fact, after 2 years at Yale, Jim Bardeen returned to the University of Washington in Seattle and spent the rest of his career there. The situation at Harvard was somewhat confused. The astronomy department had succeeded in attracting Berkeley theorist George Field as a professor and new director of the Harvard College Observatory, HCO. HCO was not really an observatory, but a set of buildings and substantial historical endowment of money that supported astronomy at Harvard. Being negotiated with the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., was a proposal that Field also be appointed director of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, SAO, which had long leased from Harvard a building conveniently next to the HCO, even connected to it by a bridge. The new combined entity would then be known as CFA, the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, with an integrated scientific program that Field would direct. It took a while and a long meandering interview with physics chair Paul Martin for me to figure out that my offer from the physics department was not really real. Yes, I would formally be an assistant professor in physics, but it was just a holding action until George took control of the new CFA, of which I would become a part. I had lunch with George at the faculty club, "Just look for someone who is 6'4" and it will be him," and was favorably impressed. But none of his vague promises could be taken as binding. The clincher was when I met with Ed Purcell, my scientific hero and mentor since my freshman year. He was very friendly, and we spent 45 minutes talking about astrophysics in general, my work on black holes, his on the alignment of interstellar dust grains, etc. When there were only 10 minutes before I had to go, I tried to get his advice on where I should go next year. "Let me tell you about our 600-foot radio telescope design," he said firmly, and we spent the rest of the time on that. The message was unmistakable. Margaret and I flew back to LA the next day. In meetings arranged at all three places that we visited, Margaret got no hint of a possible job for herself. Her father was dying of cancer, and she was still a year from getting her PhD. So what it boiled down to was that we really wanted to stay at Caltech. It was thus very welcome news when Kip took me into his office and told me that the physics department had voted me an assistant professor position. There had been a long discussion about the dangers of inbreeding, but in the end, the vote was 30-2, then re-voted to make it unanimous. Tommy, both conflicted and ill, did not attend the meeting. The appointment still had to go through the Caltech administration, but this was a formality. My future was secure, I thought. Kip started making plans to go on sabbatical leave the next academic year. He would be leaving me, his new assistant professor, in charge of the relativity group. He had just taken on two new students, Don Page and Carl Caves, but he thought that while on sabbatical, he could supervise them remotely. "I should start thinking about taking on students of my own," he said. Don was something of an oddity at Caltech, a born-again Christian with, as he would earnestly explain if you asked, a personal relationship with Jesus. He had been homeschooled by missionary parents in Alaska, in a town with more feet of snow per year than its population. That number was around 20. In later years, Don was a postdoc with Stephen Hawking in Cambridge, then a professor at Penn State and the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Don's religiosity and charitable nature remained constant throughout his career. By Thanksgiving week, my computer program was working, and we pretty much knew that Kerr black holes were stable. Saul and I might have become more famous if they were unstable, but nature didn't cooperate in this way. Still, we were the first people in history to know this very fundamental fact about the universe. And we had beaten the competition. There was no sign that anyone else had even been able to derive the Tucholsky equation. There was, however, a small glitch. Hawking and Penrose had proved very generally, by global methods that were way over our heads, that the surface area of a black hole could not ever decrease. This applied in all circumstances. It was a good test of my program. In the computer, I irradiated the Kerr black hole with different frequencies and patterns of gravitational waves, and I calculated the change in the surface area. I should have found an increasing or constant surface area in all cases. I usually did. But in one tiny corner of parameter space, my program showed a tiny decrease. The effect was so small that it couldn't affect our conclusions about stability, but it was not just numerical round-off error. Saul already had ready to submit to the Astrophysical Journal his sole author paper deriving his equation, but we decided to hold off until we could reconcile my code. Most likely it was a small programming bug. But what if it was a tiny slub that, if you pulled on it, unraveled the whole sweater? Would it unravel the Tucholsky equation, which would be terrible for both of us? Or, unlikely but not impossible, would it bring down the mighty Hawking and Penrose, Saul and I felling two giant sequoias with our tiny little axe? Finding the bug in my program, or the error in the Tucholsky equation, became our obsession. Saul, who marginally had more to lose, checked every line of my code and thought of other kinds of tests, all of which the program passed. No one in the group knew what we were working on so intensely, or that we were struggling to avoid catastrophe, but might alternatively become famous woodcutters. November 30th, 1972, was the day that the administrative committee was supposed to act to finalize my appointment offer. Late in the afternoon, Bob Layton, the physics chairman, called and asked me to come to his office. He asked me to sit down and said simply, we were unable to get the appointment through. The Division of Physics and Astronomy had recommended me unanimously, but the other division chairs, Provost Bob Christie and President Harold Brown, the two of them both physicists, would not go along. 40% of the physics faculty were hired after getting their degrees here, Layton recited, and the committee feels that they are not necessarily the best 40%. Tommy Lauritsen was surely in that category. Since President Brown had concurred in the decision, it was final. Leighton delivered the bad news to me unemotionally, but Caltech was abuzz. By the time I got back to Kip's office, he knew about it. The administrative committee didn't always rubber stamp actions by the divisions, but this was the first time in Caltech history that a unanimous recommendation had been rejected. Kip was by turns angry and sad. "I had a dream that you would take over the relativity group, Bill, and I could stay up on my mountain and study astrophysics." Saul was angrier than I was. "That's really for shit," he said several times. The word sounded strange in his South African accent. Tommy's birthday happened to be today, so Margaret and I had dinner at Rose Villa. I waited until after dinner to tell him. He was surprised and disturbed. Unspoken were the several ways that this reflected negatively on him. By the next morning, when events had sunk in, I was angry and disgusted, but not yet depressed. I threw myself into the secret work of understanding our computer anomaly. If the Tucholsky equation was wrong, or my program couldn't be fixed, then I would let myself be officially depressed. Tommy located me at the computer terminal in Sloan Laboratory, the only one which always worked because it was the one that Dean Bonenblust used. He had been looking all over campus for me. "Willie is in Washington at a meeting along with your father," he said, and heard the news from him. Apparently, no one at Caltech had dared to call Willie with the news any earlier. "He wants you to hold off doing anything rash until he is back next week." Since I was not anticipating doing anything rash, I agreed. The morning of Willie's return, he summoned me to his office in Kellogg. His version was that my mother had called my father in Washington to tell him the bad news about me. Frank was pulled out of a National Science Board meeting to take the call. Coming back in, he whispered to Willie, "Caltech turned Bill down." "Christ," said Willie as he left the meeting to himself, call Leighton and Christy to find out what had happened. And when I found out the reason, I just about went through the roof. His voice went up about 2 octaves in the retelling, as if through the roof. Willie was Caltech's proudest homegrown product himself. He had enemies on the administrative council. Chemist Jack Roberts, whose daughter Anne was my sister's best friend in elementary school, was one of them. Willie was convinced that I was a mere pawn, that the action was aimed personally at him. This seemed, and still seems, to me unlikely, but I was not about to contradict him. "It wouldn't be right for me to tell you what I plan to do about this," he said. "I don't even want to know whether you would consider an offer from us after all this." His voice started rising again. "This thing has got to be fought out as a matter of principle." The last word went into the stratosphere. Ushering me out of his office, he said darkly, in his lowest register, "You always have to know who your friends are." By mid-December, I was becoming adjusted psychologically to the idea of moving to Princeton. I hadn't officially accepted Princeton's offer, but Wheeler knew from Kip that I was likely to. It would be throwing Margaret's career under the bus. It was not obvious how she would even finish her PhD, although finding some path for that was still a priority. By the time of the big relativity conference in New York City, an adjunct to the December annual meeting of the American Physical Society, Saul and I had still not found the problem in our calculations. We had confessed to Kip, who then spent a full Saturday with us going through every detail of our calculations and not finding an answer. Coming amidst this negativity, the New York meeting was a validating experience. I was an invited speaker, wedged in the schedule between Stephen Hawking and Kip. The world distant from Caltech seemed to consider me a real scientist. The meeting became a kaleidoscopic montage of everyone I had met professionally in the previous 4 years. Unusually extroverted, I wandered around pumping people's hands and gossiping. Larry Smarr introduced me to his new girlfriend, previously the unnamed transcendent being for whom he had gone AWOL from Lishouche, traversed the Alps by bus to visit in Italy. Here they all were: Jim Wilson, Lowell Wood, John Wheeler, and Mrs. Wheeler, Lane Houston, Jim Ipser, Bonnie Miller, no Richie, Bryce DeWitt, Bob Dicka, Martin Rees, who casually mentioned that he would be returning to Cambridge as the next Plumian professor, Lou Witten, Remo Ruffini, Stephen Hawking and his mother, Bob Wald, Martin Walker, Ken Nordvet, Victor Nee, Abe Taub, Joe Weber and Virginia Trimble, Bernie Schutz, Franco Pizzini, Gary Steigman, Jacqueline Bergeron, Jim Hartle, Jim and Rosemary Gunn, Bob Wagoner, I mentioned casually to Stephen Hawking that Saul and I had a result that was most likely our conceptual or computer bug, but might possibly be the sign of a problem with the cosmic censorship assumption in his black hole area theorem. I was not expecting his reaction to be so immediate. He summoned Jim Hartle, I located Saul, and we went to a side room. He pumped us for details, and he grasped them quickly. He then laid out for us a succession of tests and checks that, if we wanted to seriously challenge his theorem, our program would have to pass. I didn't have to like Stephen to recognize that he was very, very smart. I suppose I have to come out and say it. I didn't like Stephen as a person, then or later. Of course, I felt anguish and sympathy over his physical condition, but stripping that away, he was not a nice man. The hints of this in Jane Hawking's post-divorce account, Music to Move the Stars, 1999, were dismissed by reviewers as the spite of a jilted spouse, this after Stephen left her to marry his nurse, but to me, they rang true. I sometimes saw Stephen use his condition to bully others, as insisting that a particular person help him go to the bathroom, a person he disliked, not one of the several who would gladly have assisted. More substantively, Stephen was slipshod or slow in giving others credit for their work, and fast to claim ideas for himself or favored others when they were already in the air. The most public example of this occurred in the aftermath of a 1982 conference at Drexel, where Stephen was loath to give credit to Paul Steinhardt and Andy Albrecht for their important theoretical discovery in cosmology, going so far as to falsely accuse them of plagiarism. The matter came to a head only after Stephen's best-selling book, A Brief History of Time, was published in 1988, repeating the slander for the first time in print. With unexpected help from Newsweek magazine, Steinhardt was able to amass documentary evidence, including tape recordings of the Drexel conference, proving that Stephen's claims were false. The publisher removed the passage from later printings of the book, but Stephen never apologized or admitted fault. After Newsweek's report, the popular comic Bloom County in July 1988 ran a strip that had its character Oliver inventing a new physics theory and receiving a bomb in the mail from Stephen Hawking. Stephen's good friends Kip and Roger Penrose always defended him, but, I thought, with flimsy excuses. They understood Stephen's defects, I think, but didn't want to see his myth undermined. Yet, myth or no myth, Stephen was, I think, one of the dozen or so greatest theoretical physicists of the 20th century. Number 12, maybe. Chapter 26, Resolution. My two matters of greatest concern rather magically resolved themselves early in 1973. Late one afternoon, Kip told me to go see Bob Layton. The department secretary was already gone, so I knocked and entered his inner office. I am now able to offer you an assistant professor position at an annual salary of $15,000, he told me. This was more money than any of my other offers. How did this come about? I asked. You'll have to talk to Willie about that, he said. Willie was at home, recovering from minor urinary surgery. He had promised to piss in every room of Kellogg Lab when he returned to celebrate his recovery. I conferred with Kip. I badly wanted to stay at Caltech for a year, if only for Margaret's PhD, but I had already crossed the psychological Rubicon on ultimately going to Princeton. Could I accept Caltech's offer and then decamp after 1 year? You should talk to Willie about that, Kip said. All roads led to Willie, not unusual at Caltech. I rode my motorcycle to his house on Arden Road. I had decided to float two possibilities, only the first of which was real. I leave Caltech after 1 year and never come back. That was what I actually intended to do. Or two, I leave after 1 year, go to Princeton for a year or two for the experience, then return to Caltech. I didn't actually consider the second a viable option. If I stayed at Caltech, the stigma of inbreeding and of Willie's intervention would haunt my career forever. Still, I thought that Willie, having won the fight on inbreeding on very personal grounds, would favor the second option, at least as a polite fiction. Willie told me with some pride that he was peeing well and that he had gotten every single member of the administrative committee, whom he referred to as those sons of bitches, to change their votes, except the chemist Jack Roberts, that biggest son of a bitch of them all. To my surprise, Willie favored only my first possibility. You stick it to those sons of bitches, he said. You've earned that. It was a slightly mixed message for me that Willie didn't want me to come back to Caltech, but it was the desired outcome overall. The issue about whether the Tucholsky equation predicted a violation of Hawking's theorem resolved itself quietly. We went through Stephen's checklist. As sometimes in science, there was not a single aha moment, but just the elimination of possibilities, with tests and cross-checks at each stage. Hawking was right. We were wrong. It was a subtle coordinate effect. Coordinate effects are the bane of general relativists. Since gravity is able to actually warp space and time, it can also warp the grid of coordinates, x, y, z, say, that you are using to describe a phenomenon. When you see some effect, it is sometimes hard to decide whether it is real or just the mistaken application of slightly warped coordinates. Our effect was in the second category. The Tucholsky equation could be written down in several different coordinate systems, all equally valid. We had picked one. It turned out that the only way to be truly self-consistent was to pick one system far from the whole for outgoing gravitational waves, and a different one near the whole for waves going down the whole, and then numerically solve a differential equation, a new auxiliary Tucholsky equation, to relate the two systems. It was a good outcome for Saul's and my partnership. It wasn't a bug in my computer code, and Saul's equations weren't wrong, just slightly incomplete. The answer was something that each of us could have figured out, and eventually, when we had to, did. We finished, polished, and submitted to the Astrophysical Journal our two Kerr papers, Saul's with its derivation of the Tucholsky equation, and our joint paper demonstrating computationally that Kerr black holes were stable and might thus actually found in nature. When in due course we got back the referee's report, I read the first sentence and guffawed. The anonymous report was so obviously written by Chandra. His might it not be desirables gave him away. Our result on stability became generally accepted. It was not until 1989, more than 15 years later, that Bernard Whiting proved completely analytically, that is, without relying on the numerical evidence from a computer, the stability of the Kerr metric. By then, both Saul and I had moved on to very different things. But, if I were Saul, I would have felt a twinge of jealousy in reading Whiting's very elegant exposition. Besides black holes, I was also working on an idea that had come to me while glad-handing my way through the New York relativity meeting. Since gravity warps space, it also bends the path of light rays. If a gravitating object is close to the line between you and a more distant star, it is possible for you to see two apparent images of that star, one from rays that were bent left around the gravitating object, the other from rays that were bent right, but both ending up at your eyeball, or telescope. That wasn't my idea. Einstein published an article about it in 1936, and Fritz Zwicky had followed in 1937 with a paper that proposed clusters of galaxies as the intermediate gravitating object. Zwicky was still around at Caltech, retired as a professor, and more than a bit crazy. He was a compact man with a thick Swiss accent. We called him the Gnome of Robinson Hall, the astronomy building. He used to visit us graduate students to be sure that we knew about his self-described achievements. For example, that he had invented the concept of the black hole in 1934, 5 years before Oppenheimer's 1939 paper, and 30 years before John Wheeler had invented the name, all true, to some degree. And that he had invented the aeropulse during World War II, we would call it a pulse jet, before the Germans used it in the V-1 flying bomb. He also claimed to hold a 1948 patent on the hydropulse and terrapulse, which would fly in water and solid rock, respectively. Soon, he said, he would be going back to Switzerland to help the Swiss build a terrapulse for tunneling the Alps. Caltech's astronomy librarian had to razor blade the preface out of the printed Zwicky catalog of galaxies and clusters of galaxies because it was mostly slanderous personal attacks against his Caltech colleagues, all named. Up to now, that is 1973, no actual gravitational lenses had ever been seen. My idea was to calculate whether they should be seen. At this time, it was a matter of continuing debate whether the universe was closed or open. These were terms of art that described the two possibilities of a Big Bang that either closed, had mass enough so that gravity's attraction would eventually bring the expansion to a halt and turn it around into a big crunch, that term another Wheelerism, or else open, not enough mass, so that the Big Bang would go on expanding forever. What I had found was a relation between this overall mass density of the universe and the probability that any given line of sight to any given distant object should by chance be gravitationally lensed. Roughly speaking, lenses should be very common in a closed universe, less common, but still occasionally there, in an open universe that was compatible with what we already knew. The universe couldn't be too open, or else we wouldn't see all the galaxies that we did see in the sky. I thought that this was a solid piece of pre-observational theory. That is, it pointed the way to a specific observational program. Observers, go look for lenses, because you'll probably find them. Jim Gunn, to whom I took the idea, liked it and urged me to write a quick paper. I started in. Writing the theory part was easy, but then came the hortatory part, where I was supposed to urge the observers to go forth. I didn't know how to do this well. I didn't speak observeries, so I went back to Gunn and pleaded with him to be a co-author and write that section of the paper. He agreed, and fairly quickly gave me his pencil manuscript. It was practically illegible, but the prose was very elegant. Kip, who had taught me scientific writing, wrote in clear, school Marmish prose. Jim's writing style was polished and sophisticated. Unrelated to his scientific talents, it increased my respect for him. I'll jump out of time now to say more about gravitational lenses and the idea of pre-discovery. Press and Gunn was published in 1973 in the Astrophysical Journal. It was duly noted by a handful of theorists and observers, and then rapidly sank into obscurity. No observers, not even my co-author Gunn, rushed to propose observing programs on major telescopes to look for lenses. 6 years later, a team of astronomers accidentally discovered what was apparently two quasars with identical spectra very close together in the sky. News of this spread rapidly among astronomers by phone. "It's one quasar with two images. It's a gravitational lens," I said immediately to the colleague who told me about the discovery. "How do you know that?" he said. "Gunn and I predicted it," I said. Within days, and not just from me, it became accepted that a first gravitational lens had been discovered. But perhaps because the discovery was accidental rather than purposeful, the formal discovery paper didn't include my paper among the handful of previous papers cited. After that, there was a gravitational lens gold rush, with many lenses discovered in the sky and over decades, thousands of papers published. Some small fraction of these authors, about 250, were scholarly enough to unearth and cite my paper. 250 is considered a large number of citations. But if our paper had led to the discovery, its number of citations would be in the thousands. Pre-discovery papers, so-called, are hit or miss in this way. Sometimes they become the foundational papers of whole fields. Sometimes they languish in obscurity and are found only by historians of science years too late. Gunn's and my paper was something in between. 1 week, the physics department colloquium was given by a Princeton professor named Jerry O'Neill. He was an experimental particle physicist, but his topic was the colonization of space. His idea was that the whole Earth would become a giant park, while all humans would live in orbiting utopias, healthy, happy, and he said, with unlimited pleasures of all sorts. His wife, a sinuously tall and beautiful woman with waist-length red hair, I expected her to be the high priestess of this cult, projected his slides for him. The human race would increase its population 20,000-fold, he said. Adding to O'Neill's aura as a crackpot, he looked and dressed exactly like Mr. Spock, the alien on Star Trek. The audience didn't take his message well. Bob Kirshner, my Harvard undergraduate friend, by now a Caltech graduate student, asked the most sensible one-word question, why? Fritz Zwicky, on the other hand, chewed O'Neill out for not being visionary enough. "This is all old hat," he announced scornfully. "If you only had looked at my 1948 Halley lecture, you would have seen that my work went far beyond these crude concepts." There was scattered applause in support of our local crackpot over this Princeton imposter. Paul Schechter, in my entering graduate cohort, was by now well into his thesis work with Jim Gunn as his advisor. Paul was working on the mass function of galaxies. That meant, if you took a big volume of space, how many galaxies of each different mass or mass range would there be in it? That distribution, plotted as a histogram as a function of galaxy mass, was the mass function. Paul was analyzing published data in a new way and finding that the mass function could be accurately described by a very simple mathematical formula. Gunn was not very interested in Paul's work. It hadn't crystallized into a clear statement about anything. It was just a curious formula. But it was so beautiful. After Paul showed me the data, I couldn't stop thinking about it. At this time, little was known about how galaxies formed. In the absence of any real understanding, the community inevitably divided into two camps: top-down and bottom-up. Top-down meant that the biggest structures in the universe, then thought to be clusters of galaxies, should form first and then fragment into galaxies, which might fragment into smaller galaxies, and so on. Bottom-up meant that small galaxies, or maybe the even smaller globular star clusters, should form first, then aggregate by gravity to make larger galaxies, with clusters of galaxies forming last. At meetings, astronomers nearly came to blows defending one position or the other, rather like the big Endians and little Endians in Gulliver's Travels. I didn't have a dog in the fight, but if top-down was correct, it would involve messy radiative hydrodynamics. The physics of each stage of fragmentation would be different and difficult, and I had no idea how to calculate the mass function. If bottom-up were correct, however, the aggregation on each scale would, at least for a while, be driven purely by gravity, which I thought I could calculate. There might be messy hydrodynamics later on for each scale, but that wouldn't affect the mass function. Gravity by itself didn't care about scale, so the same calculation would have to apply on all scales, a property called self-similarity. It was surprisingly easy to construct a self-similar solution to the problem of hierarchical condensation under the influence of gravity. I had the answer in a week. The mathematics led to almost exactly Paul Schechter's beautiful empirical formula. I decided to write a computer program that would simulate the process by following the trajectories of little point gravitating masses, something called an n-body calculation. This took a few weeks. By later standards, the program was very crude, but it showed good agreement with the mathematics and helped validate the assumption of self-similarity and some other assumptions that I had made. The whole thing was so simple, I couldn't believe that it was not an already known result. Jim Peebles at Princeton was the dominant figure in this field of cosmological perturbations. His published lecture notes were considered the ultimate authority. I could almost locate the page where he could have done what I did, but he hadn't. Paul and I published a joint paper on what became known as the Press-Schechter formalism. It was not a completely happy collaboration, because I wanted to publish and move on, while Paul was a perfectionist who could always think of something additional to tweak and delay. His solo paper on the empirical data and his mathematical formula came out 2 years after our joint paper did, for just this reason. Our paper, Formation of Galaxies and Clusters of Galaxies by Self-Similar Gravitational Condensation, became cited by others more than 5,000 times. Werner Heisenberg invented quantum mechanics in 1925. Only Erwin Schrödinger shares credit in the same magnitude. During World War II, Heisenberg worked willingly, some say enthusiastically, on Hitler's atomic bomb project. A fixture of German science in the post-war period, he was elsewhere largely shunned. In 1971, he published an apologist memoir, Physics and Beyond, that ought to have been titled, I Wasn't Really a Nazi. In 1973, thus rehabilitated, in his own eyes anyway, he toured the United States giving a lecture on the brainchild of his later years, a unified field theory that would explain all of physics. At Caltech, his physics colloquium had to be moved to Beckman Auditorium because of the overflow crowd. Feynman introduced Heisenberg with the words, I never expected that I would get to meet my hero, much less introduce him. Presumably, he meant scientific, not humanitarian, hero. A small private dinner for Heisenberg had been arranged for after the seminar. Kip had something to do with organizing it, so Doug Eardley and I were invited, along with Bohm, Christie, Feynman, Gunn, Mandula, Ravindahl, Thorne, Zachariasen, and Zweig. Heisenberg conversed expansively with Christie, Feynman, and Zweig, while the rest of us around the table listened politely. The discussion was about science administration, how German science was funded, what were the strengths of its organization through the Max Planck Institutes, and so on. On all of this, Heisenberg was manifestly current. He knew facts, numbers, budgets, and internal politics, the very model of a modern administrator. I thought that perhaps his unified field theory was only an indulgence, not the obsession his talk had made it appear. But, over dessert, he returned to that subject. Zweig was drawing him out, and Heisenberg was responding with a glow of satisfaction. His claims for the theory became more and more inflated as the discussion proceeded. Feynman had been buttering up his hero all evening, talking about the greatness of his original discovery, etc. Now he suddenly interrupted in quite a different tone. "Professor Heisenberg, I don't believe that your theory makes any of those predictions." Everyone except Heisenberg knew at once what had happened. Feynman's red line had been crossed. Heisenberg may have invented quantum mechanics at age 24, but now, at age 72, he was guilty of intellectual dishonesty. For Feynman, this was the sin that could not be tolerated. Feynman continued, "Professor Heisenberg, I'd like to tell you about my unified field theory." "Yes," said Heisenberg, immediately suspicious. "I have a very beautiful equation," Feynman said. "Split squirt equals splonk." "Those are nonsense words," Bohm explained to Heisenberg on his right. Feynman continued, "This equation makes a lot of important predictions, which are all in amazing agreement with experiment. Of course, nobody can understand exactly how I get the predictions, but that's because it's a very complicated equation." Bob Christie came out of shock enough to interject, "Well, Richard, I'm sure that either you or Professor Heisenberg will solve the problem before long," and forcibly changed the subject. The dinner ended soon afterward. Heisenberg made a point of shaking hands with Feynman very warmly. Of course, he must have known that Feynman was Jewish. There were other dinners with famous physicists. Kolotnikov, the Soviet cosmologist and condensed matter physicist, was so evidently bored at the dinner in his honor that everyone simply stopped talking to him. Instead, at our end of the table, Saul, Doug, Alan, and I discussed how we would convince Sir Isaac Newton that we were really time travelers from the future. My best answer was that Saul would work out a lot of complicated indefinite integrals. Newton had invented calculus and was thus better at it than anyone then on the planet. But Saul could easily show himself to be even more advanced. His brain held 250 plus years of other people's further developments. Doug thought that I should bring along my amateur's 6-inch telescope mirror and then break it to show that it wasn't really so valuable. My telescope cost $200. Newton's most ambitious astronomical reflector was less than 2 inches in diameter. Caltech's commencement day was on a Friday in the first week of June. I was officially being awarded my doctorate, but I had decided not to go through the ordeal of standing out in the sun in a hot black robe. Saul finished his thesis and passed his oral thesis exam in July. On August 1, 1973, I became an assistant professor of theoretical physics at Caltech. I had my own parking space with my name stenciled on it. Margaret still had a year to go to get her PhD. We decided to move to the beach, partly for just the novelty of it, partly to make Margaret's commute to UCLA easier. One weekend, we explored a piece of geography along the ocean, 1 block wide and 10 miles long, from the marina north through Santa Monica to Pacific Palisades. Venice Beach, officially part of LA, seemed like our kind of place, a mix of old slum and new gentrification. If I avoided the worst of rush hour, I would have a 45-minute commute to Caltech, Margaret a 15-minute commute to UCLA. Within a couple of days, Margaret located a rental house, the lower floor of a duplex at 19 Horizon Avenue, 4 houses from the boardwalk and the sandy beach, a block from the pavilion and adjacent Muscle Beach, where weightlifters from nearby Gold's Gym perfected their natural tans and were gawked at by admirers. At the time, this was the one and only Gold's Gym. Arnold Schwarzenegger must have been among the specimens that we gawked at on Muscle Beach, but he was only one of many. The house was newly renovated, the interior done in unfinished redwood planking. We moved in at the end of August. Chapter 27. Zeldovich, the extraordinary General Assembly of the International Astronomical Union, was held in Warsaw, People's Republic of Poland, in September 1973. The IAU was the international professional society to which astronomers belonged, and it held general assemblies once every 3 years. The 500th anniversary of the birth of Copernicus was what made this particular meeting extraordinary. This was my first trip behind the Iron Curtain. There was only one flight a day to Warsaw from Frankfurt on Lufthansa. My flight was commandeered at the last minute by a German girls' orchestra on a cultural exchange visit. I was about 10th in line when the woman at the counter announced, in German, that there was only one seat left. "I'm alone," I shouted, and got the seat. At the hotel, although I had reserved a room with bath, there were none such. Also, the hotel restaurant was not open for dinner. A tourist guide person in the lobby informed me that the official cashier was closed for the day. "How can I get local currency to buy dinner?" He told me to go to my room and wait. A half hour later, he knocked at my door and offered me 60 zlotys to the dollar. The official rate was 33, and black market exchanges were illegal, but I exchanged dollars for a huge wad of zlotys. Immediately, I wondered if I was being set up, if the next knock on my door would be the secret police. Better, I should have wondered if I could have bargained for a better rate. Almost certainly the case. Glancing constantly over my shoulder to see if I was being followed, I walked to the Palace of Culture and Science, a 30-story Stalinist monolith, and registered for the meetings. On the walk back to my hotel, I was still haunted by my black market transaction. The same guide was hanging around in the lobby. Perhaps he was the secret police. Impulsively, I gave him 300 zlotys. "For your services while I'm here," I said. He took the money and nodded knowingly. It turned out to be a very good investment. At breakfast every day, I was the only person who was brought a bottle of mineral water. Everyone else got only questionable tap water or tepid tea. And when there were queues, as there always were, for things like dropping off or picking up room keys, which were not allowed out of the hotel, he would materialize and short-circuit the line for me. On the final day, when people were trying to get to the airport, there were no taxis, except one that he got especially for me. I insisted that Claudio and Sonia Tadelboim ride with me. Both from Chile, he was my co-equal assistant professor in Wheeler's group at Princeton. The two were unlikely to ever get a cab on their own, because with Latin temperaments, they had crossed swords with my lackey on the matter of a $6 overpayment to him. "I will allow you to ride only because you are friends of Mr. Press," my lackey said grimly as he put them into my taxi. There were 2 days of meetings in Warsaw, then the invitational two-day Copernicus meeting on cosmology in Krakow. Other subfields had their own sidebar meetings, then a final day in Warsaw. A highlight for me was meeting the Soviets, especially Zeldovich and those in his group. Because of his bomb work, Zeldovich was never allowed to travel to the West, but his travel to satellite Eastern Bloc countries was permitted. I heard him make the same joke in English to several audiences. "I am able to achieve cosmic velocity 1, but not cosmic velocity 2. A full understanding of the joke depended on knowing that the literal cosmic velocity 1 in Russian was better rendered in English as orbital velocity, and that cosmic velocity 2 meant escape velocity. Zeldovich was a short, crew-cut bulldog of a man. He looked like a wrestler. In his presence, there was no question about who was in charge. I introduced myself to him in a coffee break. "Just Zeldovich, not professor," he said curtly. He knew about me from Kip. "Go talk to Starobinsky," he said. Alexei Starobinsky was a thin young man in his early 20s with excellent English but a terrible stutter. He was the most mathematical of the Zeldovich group and worked in isolation on Kerr black holes. He had failed to derive the Tucholsky equation before Saul did, but he had been close. Once he knew about Saul's equation, from Kip, he had arrived at exactly the same coordinate effect difficulty that had caused us so much grief. Saul had found an auxiliary equation that I had to solve on the computer. Alexei had found the exact solution to that equation. This immediately earned him our respect. Saul, also at the Warsaw meeting, spent some hours off with Alexei over the next several days. I wasn't selling black holes anymore. I was selling Press-Schechter self-similar condensation. I again cornered Zeldovich. He had heard from Kip about this work too. "It's wrong," he said. "Go talk to Doroshkevich." Doroshkevich was a dour man in his mid-30s. He spoke only very broken English and looked like a KGB agent. although the absence of KGB and the Zeldovich Group was one of few things in the Soviet Union that could be relied on. Doroshkevich put me off with, "I will talk to you about this at 4 yesterday." "Tomorrow?" I asked. I always confused yesterday and tomorrow when I was learning Russian, so maybe he confused them in English. "No, yesterday," he said, annoyed. He meant today. We met in his hotel room and communicated mostly by equations and drawing graphs. He started by telling me that my work was all wrong, but after an hour, he was not so convinced and adjourned our meeting peremptorily. "He would think about it," he said. The next morning, Zeldovich, acting more border collie than bulldog, cut me out of the crowd. "Press, I will meet with you at 7 tonight in my hotel room." The day's cultural excursion was to the birthplace of Chopin and included a concert. I helped Jane Hawking with the logistical chore of transporting Stephen. We got back to Warsaw just in time for my appointment. No time for dinner. I made my way through anonymous crowds to the Warsaw Hotel, where all the Russians were staying, and up to Zeldovich's room. I was carrying my very American-looking attaché case and felt as if I was acting in some film of diplomatic intrigue. Here, visiting the father of the Soviet atomic bomb. The hotel room was like a doctor's waiting room. Those with appointments sat on the bed waiting for Zeldovich to finish with previous arrivals. He was talking to Sidney Bludman, who said that he had written the Soviet Academy to invite Zeldovich to a neutrino conference in Philadelphia. Zeldovich thanked him and asked for a written invitation to be sent to him personally. "I collect them," he said with heavy irony, another joke about his inability to travel. An East German arrived and joined me sitting on the bed. Then it was my turn. Zeldovich first asked how old I was. He then asked me to explain exactly what I had done in my numerical experiments. I explained. When I started to give my interpretation of the experiment, he interrupted. Exactly like Feynman, he wanted only to know the undisputed facts. He would make his own interpretations. He offered a few comments to show that he now understood the problem and said that he would think about it. He would talk to me in Krakow, he said. He led me out the door to the elevator, shook hands, and turned, speaking German, to the next person in line on the bed. So, next in Krakow, I cornered him as the meetings were breaking for dinner. "Have you thought about my problem?" I whined. "Come to dinner with us," he commanded. "Us" was Zeldovich, Novikov, and Doroshkevich. There was a line at the hotel restaurant, and Zeldovich, impatient, led us out of the hotel and a few blocks to a Mleshny bar, a cheap restaurant serving dairy and light snacks. The Polish waiter pretended not to understand Russian, so the Russians had to tell me what they wanted to order in Russian, and I then pretended to translate it into English, which the waiter barely spoke. But he knew that I was American, and he had in any case understood their orders in the original Russian. The Poles hated the Russians almost as much as they hated the Germans. Still, older Poles, when they didn't speak any English, often spoke German, but unwillingly. I learned that when English failed, I could say, "Ich bin Amerikaner. Nun sprechen Sie Deutsch." That first part was essential, otherwise they didn't speak any German either. Zeldovich disbelieved the results of my numerical experiment, period. He agreed that there might be some nonlinear power law for clustering, but was sure that the exponent was much less than my claimed value of 2. He listened to me for 15 minutes, then said, "We will bet," and then no more discussion. The bet, on whether the exponent was greater or less than 1.5, was a bottle of White Horse Scotch, his favorite, against a bottle of Stolichnaya vodka. Also, he said he would like the Beatles record, When I'm 64, and the sequel to the novel $100 Misunderstanding. This novel, by Robert Gover, was a satire on American racism, available in the Soviet Union. The Soviets allowed only American works that showed the United States in a bad light. The sequel was apparently unavailable. Out of the restaurant, we walked along quiet residential streets. I asked his view on Watergate. "It would all blow over," he said. It was part of the same political system in which the captains of industry planned and paid for the Kennedy assassination. These same plutocrats would, in the end, rescue Nixon, their man. He and Doroshkevich laughed at my assertion that there was no such organized conspiracy. I tried to explain the magnitude of Nixon's crimes, his attempt to use the CIA domestically as a secret police apparatus. But you already have the FBI as your secret police, he said. That's quite different, I said, thinking of the patriotic FBI television series that Margaret and I used to watch. It is beyond the intellectual powers of a Soviet citizen, Zeldovich remarked drearily, to distinguish between a bad CIA and a good FBI. There was supposed to be a session of short 10-minute talks, in theory chosen by the conference organizers, but in practice by Zeldovich. I was hoping to be one of the chosen, but had heard nothing. After the previous night's dinner conversation, I was not optimistic. Martin Rees usually knew what was going on, and I approached him. He told me that Zeldovich had actually appointed him to choose the talks, but during the whole conversation had addressed him as Joe Silk, creating some ambiguity about who was actually appointed. Silk was a British cosmologist who was long a professor at Berkeley. He returned to the UK in 1999 as the civilian professor at Oxford. We went to Novikov, who, as Zeldovich's deputy, told Martin to pick the speakers. So in the end, I did get to talk. Zeldovich then rose and commented to the audience that my result was wrong, but that the whole thing would be settled by a bet and was not worth discussing further. I'll have to jump out of time to relate how our bet came out. About a year after Nixon resigned, a visiting Russian brought me a bottle of Stolichnaya vodka, the authentic Russian kind, its label autographed with "For Press" from Ya B. Zeldovich. This was your bet with him on whether Nixon would resign, the visitor told me. Zeldovich had conflated our two discussions and forgotten which one we had bet on. I had won by mistake. The bet on the exponent was never settled. In fact, cosmology advanced in a direction that made the exponent irrelevant. It was not the part of Press Schechter that turned out to be lasting. Probably it was wrong, as Zeldovich thought. Luckily, no one remembered that this was the part that I had thought most important. Tommy Lauritsen, Margaret's father, died on Tuesday, October 16, 1973. He was 57. His memorial service, of course non-religious, was in the Caltech Athenaeum. The speakers were Caltech President Harold Brown, former President Lee DuBridge, Bob Lighton, who years later became Margie's second husband, one former student of Tommy's, he had very few, and Åge Bohr, who had arrived from Copenhagen the day before with his wife Marietta. Willie sat in the front row and was notable by his absence from the list of speakers. The simple explanation was that he just couldn't do it. The difference between DuBridge and Brown was that the former made deeply held feelings sound trite, while the latter was the other way around. Åge gave by far the best speech, recalling much of Tommy's liveliness, as well as his life. The whole thing lasted about an hour. Åge took me aside and invited me to visit the Bohr Institute in Copenhagen for any length of time and to be paid by them. I thanked him, but it left me uncomfortable. It was nepotism by marriage, nothing else. He wanted to prop up my career the way he and his father Niels Bohr and Willie and Faye Salove had propped up Tommy's. I did subsequently visit the Bohr Institute a couple of times for conferences, but never more than that. As an assistant professor, I had my own parking space, but I had been assigned a space north of Beckman Auditorium, as far away from my office as was geometrically possible given the shape of the campus. I had complained, of course, but to no avail. A couple of weeks after Tommy died, I got a call from a woman in the parking office. I was lucky, she said. A space close to my office had become available, and they were reassigning me. Until they repainted the name, she said, I should look for the space marked T. Lauritsen. That last spring and summer in California, I was busy with things that, as far as my career was concerned, were off the main road. Maybe even were dead ends. My minimal effort approach as an undergraduate physics major at Harvard had relied on problem books in various areas of physics, so I felt something of a duty to write one on gravitation physics for the benefit of future lazy students. I coerced Saul, Alan Lightman, and, remotely in Utah, Richard Price into becoming co-authors. The activity was not useless. It could be a worthy, lesser companion volume to the Magisterial Gravitation by Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, which had finally come out as a massive volume. Not useless, but not career-enhancing either, and not something that Saul and Alan should have undertaken before finishing their theses. We did it anyway. For 1 month, we were each supposed to come up with 10 problems a day. We didn't have to solve them at this stage, just make them up, or find them by combing through textbooks and old journal articles. Many came from Kip's course. Sometimes at lunch, I cajoled Dick Feynman into thinking of problems. At month's end, no author actually met his daily quota, but we did finish with more than 600 candidate problems. Then, we spent the next year, part-time, dividing up the work of producing good solutions. Many problems were lost on the cutting room floor. The book, as finally published by Princeton University Press in 1975 and still in print today, had 475 problems, all with, we thought modestly, excellent solutions. Kip and others thought that I was similarly nuts to write a paper on how the size of a human, call it 2 meters in height, is not arbitrary, but, in order of magnitude, is uniquely determined by fundamental physical constants. There was a long history among physicists in thus estimating, purely recreationally, various quantities. The sun has the mass it has, for example, because if it was much less massive, it wouldn't be luminous enough to support life on Earth. Much more massive, its lifetime would be too short. One uses physics to convert arguments like this into numerical expressions involving the mass of the proton, the speed of light, Planck's constant, etc. My paper was published in a journal for college physics teachers, earning only scorn from Kip. But I was unexpectedly vindicated by the arrival at Caltech of Vicky Weisskopf, MIT's most famous elder theoretical physicist, to give a physics department colloquium. Weisskopf had worked as a young man with the greats of modern physics, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, Wolfgang Pauli, and Niels Bohr. During World War II, he was a group leader on the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos. He was almost a co-discoverer of quantum electrodynamics, along with Feynman and Schwinger. His calculation of the measured Lamb shift gave the correct value, but he was not sufficiently confident in its foundations to publish it. A special luncheon in the Athenaeum private dining room was given in Vicky's honor. "Oh, I have read your paper on the size of man," he said when introduced to me. Heads turned to listen. "I've been working myself along those lines," he continued, "but I didn't get as far as you did." No one knew what we were talking about, but they were very impressed that I was ahead of Weisskopf in something. Murray Gell-Mann had been Weisskopf's student and made a point of coming up to me and shaking my hand warmly. Later, there was a luncheon engagement with an associate editor from Reader's Digest who was traveling around doing a story on black holes. The Digest's 40 million readers seemed to pull a lot of weight at Caltech. This junior editor was being squired by the Caltech news director, who picked up the tab for our lunch at the Athenaeum. The editor said that he wanted to take the gee whiz out of black holes and to make them something that the average American could understand, like electric toasters. "Good idea," I said. He felt he must do this soon because, he said, this bandying about of mystical-sounding scientific terms was promoting a resurgence of interest in the occult, especially witchcraft and psychic power, and this, if not halted, would lead to the rise of new fascism. "A very interesting perspective," I said. Then he got down to the first electric toaster question about black holes. "Tell me, Dr. Press, do you think that black holes support the Kantian idea of absolute reality?" Chapter 28. Princeton. From the very first, we didn't like Princeton, and it didn't like us. University and town were obsessed with the picturesque and quaint. It was a matter of pride that faux colonial Nassau Street had changed not a bit since the time of Woodrow Wilson and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Jadwin Hall, the relatively new physics building, modern in architecture, was banished half a mile down Washington Road toward Lake Carnegie. Jadwin and neighboring Fine Hall, mathematics, won several architectural awards. I learned later that John Wheeler had been instrumental in pressing the university to depart from the prevailing neo-Gothic in building them and in including spaces for modern outdoor sculpture in the design. The Wheeler's own home was a striking mid-century modern. He had collaborated with the architect in its design. It was years before, confronted with many such facts, I could admit that Wheeler was not in all matters the conservative defender of the old guard that I took him for. He was a radical. Or was he? That was the paradox. Hibben Apartments, situated another half mile away on the lake, embodied in brutalist concrete the university's stratified academic structure. Hibben, with its neighboring clone McGee, comprised apartments rented to lecturers and assistant professors, the junior faculty with very little chance of achieving tenure. We were itinerant scholars whose fate was to pass through the university, leaving behind no ripple on Lake Carnegie, no academic graffiti that could not easily be removed. We were expected to be grateful for the opportunity to have been at Princeton, adding its prestige to our academic resumes and departing with fond memories of watching, from our concrete-walled apartments, the geometrical wakes of the undergraduate sculling practice. This just didn't work for Margaret and me. I made some mistakes right away. On a hot day, I was in shirt sleeves and tennis shoes when I presented myself to the university personnel office to sign the onboarding forms. Logically enough, I was shunted to a line of tie and jacketless new employees, the mailroom clerks and computer operators, with then strained apologies when, at the front of the line, they discovered that I was an assistant professor. In Jadwin, when my boxes of books started arriving on the loading dock, I made the mistake of borrowing a hand truck and moving them myself to my office. "We do have help for that kind of thing, Dr. Press," Mrs. Witt, John Wheeler's kindly elderly secretary, solemnly rebuked me. That help was all black, or, as they were still called in Princeton, 10 years after the Civil Rights Movement, Negro. I don't remember who provided me with this useful mental construct. Princeton is 200 miles south and 20 years back in time from where you think it is. In 1975, no less so than in 1875, Princeton was where the prominent families of the South sent their sons to be educated, a halfway house to the industrial and professional guilds of the Northeast. Harvard and Yale were bridges too far. Woodrow Wilson, Princeton's greatest president before becoming governor of New Jersey and then president of the United States, grew up in Georgia and was at heart an antebellum Southerner. New Jersey was the last of the northern states to abolish slavery, and it did so in 1846 by converting all slaves to the status of indentured servants who were apprenticed for life. Anti-Semitism had its own place in the Princetonian tradition. Murph Goldberger, my department chairman in physics, was Jewish. Extolling everything good about Princeton, he told me that, already a decade ago, Jews were admitted to the Springdale Golf Club, home turf of the university's varsity golf team, whose land was owned by the university. The real business in the physics department was done in senior faculty meetings with junior faculty excluded. Instead of faculty meetings, instructors and assistant professors were expected to attend the weekly Joseph Henry Club, so-called, a forum for lesser issues such as whether the quota for graduate student use of the Xerox machine should be raised from $5 per student per year to $10. Because of its guaranteed captive audience, the Joseph Henry Club was a useful venue for seminars by visiting great men for whom a regular physics department colloquium might prove embarrassing. This because many great men had nothing really to talk about. Once I figured this out, I started sitting at the back of the room, next to a door that led to a small kitchen. From there, another door opened to the hallway. The kitchen door was kept locked, but I had discovered that my building key could quietly unlock it. I escaped from several embarrassing talks, discreetly, I thought, through that door. I was noticed, apparently. Mrs. Witt came to me one day to tell me, apologetically, that a mistake had been made in issuing my building key, which she insisted on exchanging on the spot for a different one. I thought nothing of this until I next tried to escape the Joseph Henry Club and found that my key no longer opened the secret exit door. Embarrassingly, I was caught out, fiddling with a lock that wouldn't open. Nothing in this event pointed back to John Wheeler, except the style of the exploit. Somewhat akin to Kip's plan to motivate me, Wheeler planned to train me to act Princetonian, even if only for the short period that I was expected to be there. He was less open about his plan than Kip had been, but there were times that it came through very clearly. "Jeanette and I moved many times in my career," he told me, "and every time we arrived at a new place, we acted like we were planning to stay forever." The italics and the message were clear. Margaret and I settled into our apartment in Hibben and awaited the birth of our baby daughter. Hibben was an 8-story rectangular box, and each apartment was a duplex with an interior staircase, so the levels with exterior walkways were numbered 1 to 4, with apartments A to T down the length of each straight walkway. The architecture was a scaled-up rabbit hutch where, it was commonly joked, junior faculty were put to breed. We were in apartment 3M. On the side facing Lake Carnegie, a communal laundry room and a children's play area opened onto a pleasant grassy area that sloped gently to the shoreline. There were benches and swings, and no shortage of advanced degrees among the women doing laundry and minding children. Margaret's PhD in linguistics fit right in. The side of the building away from the lake faced a parking lot and a walkway that crossed Faculty Road and continued up to the campus. At 7:50 every morning, this walkway was a moving line of assistant professors in jackets and ties, with or without overcoats, depending on season, on their way to teach 8 classes. One of them, I never found out a name, used to sing an original ditty, "Hippity-hoppity, hippity-hoppity, the Hibbon rabbits go to work." His clear baritone carried across the parking lot. Moving in was a matter of unpacking boxes and trips on Route 1, north to Sears in New Brunswick, and south to Mrs. G's Appliances in Lawrence Township. The apartments didn't come with refrigerators for some reason. And to a place that sold cheap, unfinished furniture that I could stain and varnish myself. There was a series of largely pro forma welcoming events, a tea at John and Nita Bockhall's, they, at any rate, a breath of fresh air in Princeton, and a physics department party at the Goldbergers, at which John Wheeler took Margaret and me around to meet the department's great men. That event was educational in itself. Margaret was accustomed to being introduced first, so she held out her hand to each, announcing, "Hello, I'm Margaret Press." After 2 such, Wheeler gently corrected her with, "This is William Press, and this is Mrs. Press." Over the first months, there were many similar gentle corrections. We took them in stride, attributing them to Princeton's greater formality, re-Pasadena, and the more rigid social stratification. It didn't occur to us that there was another effect. At Caltech, we were royalty, the princess and prince who united 2 Caltech royal families. In Princeton, I was just another transitory assistant professor, with Margaret, my invisible and pregnant wife. The rigid pecking order was this: tenured faculty at the top, then undergraduates. The university's primary purpose was to give its undergraduates the full Princetonian experience. Everything else, including any accomplishment as a research university, was secondary. After undergraduates in status came the long-serving administrative staff, people like Mrs. Witt. Then assistant professors and lecturers. At the very bottom, graduate students. And below the very bottom, the wives of junior faculty, who were expected to be rarely seen, never heard. And to leave academic house arrest in Hibbon or McGee only for driving to the northern edge of town to the supermarket in the Princeton Shopping Center. This did not sit well with Margaret. Physics faculty at Princeton, as at other first-rate places, had very light teaching loads. My course on general relativity met 3 times a week. I had 20 or so graduate students, plus 6 advanced undergraduates. The graduate students were docile and merely took notes. I didn't have to grade them. Princeton's system, more extreme even than Caltech's, was to assess their progress solely on the basis of candidacy exams taken at the end of their first year. My 6 undergraduates were troublemakers, and I loved them for that. Their mutiny committee, as I called it, Messrs. Grossman and Black, visited me frequently to question my professional ethics in general and the need for some particular assignment in particular. It was only 5 years since I had led the corresponding mutiny committee in Dick McCrae's astrophysics course at Harvard. To this day, I don't understand John Wheeler's worship of great men, a term that he actually used. I respected the historical figures in physics for their famous discoveries. I was awed by some that I had interacted with, Feynman, Chandrasekhar, even by some whom I disliked personally, like Murray Gell-Mann. Stephen Hawking was not yet a great man in the Wheelerian universe, but it was already clear that he was going to be. I was with Chandra in believing, as in his story about Bohr, that genius was a transitory thing, and that great men should at some point be respectfully let out to pasture. Chandra hated Wheeler's apocalyptic style. He told me that the guru who, in Indian fables, goes into the woods to become wise by contemplation, teaches his acolytes to be in harmony with nature. Chandra's interpretation of this, for the modern scientist, was, do work that is harmonious with your time, not work that attempts to be disruptive and is most likely wrong. That was his view of Wheeler's work. In truth, I could see merit in both sides of the argument. Wheeler led a weekly group meeting that included his undergraduates, those being advised on their senior theses, graduate students, postdocs, and his two assistant professors, Claudio Teitelbaum and me. 1 week, Wheeler assigned Thibaut D'Amour to report to the group on a paper that put forth an alternative to the Big Bang Theory, complete with alternative explanation for the 3-degree cosmic microwave background. If viable, this would be important. Thibaut was a French postdoc supported by the French government to spend 2 years in Wheeler's group. It was clear even from D'Amour's languorous presentation that the paper was crackpot, not even wrong, the ultimate insult among physicists. "Who wrote this garbage?" I asked politely after airing some more objective criticisms of the paper. Wheeler stared at me. "Klein," he said, and added, "Perhaps you've heard of the Klein-Gordon equation or the Klein-Nishina formula." Yes, I had. With those and many other discoveries to his credit, Swedish physicist Oscar Klein was certainly a great man. He had retired in 1962 and was now in his 80s. "If he's wrong, let's write him a letter and tell him so," Wheeler said, adding, "I'll sign it with you." I didn't know whether he was calling my bluff. If you are critical of a great man, you should have the courage to confront him, or just seizing on a teachable moment for his undergraduates. This is how science is done. So, I took the other side. If a person like Klein wanted to pretend to be still making great discoveries, and if it wasn't obstructing the advance of reputable work, then why should we puncture his balloon? "For scientific honesty, of course," Wheeler said. Those were strong words directed against me. Johnny was on a tear. He picked up the phone and dialed Mrs. Witt, then dictated, for all to hear, a pedantic letter, quite insulting to Klein, with each sentence followed by boxes for him to check, true or false, and then return the letter by way of letting us know your thinking on this matter. I don't think the letter was ever sent. I know that I never signed it. After Wheeler put down the phone, I related what I had witnessed when Feynman confronted Heisenberg on the latter's crackpot theory. Feynman had reacted only after being goaded in public, and I thought it also pertinent that Heisenberg had been a Nazi. I didn't know anything about Klein's politics. Wheeler said that Heisenberg had visited Princeton shortly after Caltech and had given the same talk. Heisenberg came away from Caltech thinking that Feynman was a mere bourgeois physicist who didn't appreciate the depth of his work, Wheeler said. It is physics lore that Wheeler himself referred to Feynman, his greatest student, as a mere bourgeois physicist, adept at calculating anything but unappreciative of Wheeler's grand conceptual vistas. So it is possible that, in regard to Heisenberg, Wheeler was putting his own words into the latter's mouth. The invisible elephant in the room was not Klein's work, nor Heisenberg's, but Wheeler's own. His principal scientific interest had now become human consciousness, and whether consciousness had a role in understanding the collapse of the wave packet in quantum mechanics, and if so, whether the whole universe might have come into classical existence only when first consciously observed by intelligent life. To an earlier group meeting, he had invited two psychologists from Harvard who were supposed to be experts on consciousness. They had become restive and then visibly eager to escape when he had surfaced his quantum ideas. This same elephant was in my office later that afternoon when Wheeler appeared there. Shutting the door, he said, "I hope that you don't view my thinking about consciousness as being in the same category as Heisenberg's unified field theory, and I hope that you will tell me if you think it's wrong." "Oh no," I said, trying to be tactful. "Your work is not in the same class as Heisenberg's." Once we were fairly settled, we invited the Wheelers to dinner at our apartment, along with Vladimir Braginsky, the Soviet experimental physicist whom I knew from Caltech and who was visiting Robert Dicke's group in Jadwin Hall. Braginsky was an outstanding physicist, but also a doctrinaire, humorless Communist Party member. The evening alternated between us baiting him, "Why is Zeldovich unable to travel?" and Jeanette Wheeler baiting us, "Don't you agree that household staff are like children? They love to receive colorfully wrapped little presents." I don't think that John Wheeler ever liked me. I don't think he liked me before he hired me during my 2 years with him or afterwards. In his view, I wasn't even up to being a bourgeois physicist. I wasn't even up to being not even wrong. Astrophysics, relativity, and cosmology events at Princeton, seminars, colloquia, informal discussions with visitors, rotated among three epicenters: the Astrophysical Sciences Department, Peyton, the Physics Department, Jadwin, and Bachall's group across town at the Institute for Advanced Study, IAS. This was a single community. It was the same audience at all the events. The highlight of the week was astrophysics lunch, on Tuesdays, in the large private dining room of the IAS cafeteria. Students were excluded. 30 or so faculty and postdocs sat around the outside of a large horseshoe of tables. The immortals, Lyman Spitzer and Martin Schwarzschild, sat at the central position, flanked by the demigods John Bachall and Jerry Ostricker. Spitzer and Schwarzschild together ruled Princeton astrophysics for a generation, passing the torch to Ostricker only in the early 1980s. Spitzer was permanent head of the Peyton Department. Born in the Midwest, he was educated at Andover and Yale. In the 1950s, he founded the field of plasma astrophysics, the study of ionized gases and magnetic fields in deep space. He was athletic and a mountain climber. Schwarzschild, a gnome of a man, witty but with a heavy accent, was born into a distinguished German-Jewish academic family. His father, in fact, was Karl Schwarzschild, discoverer of the first black hole solution to Einstein's equations. Schwarzschild the son emigrated to the United States in 1936 via Norway and served in U.S. Army intelligence during the war. His famous work on stellar structure and evolution in the 1950s added detailed physics to Chandrasekhar's 1930s mathematical treatment. In Chandra's time, the nuclear reactions that power stars were still unknown. The Tuesday lunches were conducted like a court-martial, with those four judges presiding. One never knew who would be on trial until one showed up. If a visitor was present, that person was usually the victim. Schwarzschild, or Bachall, would lay the trap. "Tell us about something you are working on. Not finished work, but just what is on your mind." The visitor would mistake this for a friendly invitation, the chance to pick the brains and get feedback from the famous and up-and-coming scientists in the room. Far from it. Allowing only a brief opening testimony, the presiding judges would interrupt to call on others in the room to criticize, rebut, or belittle whatever the visitor had said. Then the visitor might or might not be allowed to defend himself. It was brutal and knowingly malicious, justified only by the fact that everyone in the room always learned a lot, at the visitor's expense. If there were no visitor, then a similar treatment was given without warning to one or more of Princeton's own, usually assistant professors like me. The trap here was, what do you think about? Some recently announced discovery in any area of astrophysics from any place in the world. If you didn't have an answer, the judges would shame you publicly for your ignorance. After I had gotten this treatment a couple of times, I started getting stomach pains even before lunch while going through the cafeteria line, anticipating that I might be called on. After I mentioned this privately to John Bachall, in his role as my mentor, he sometimes phoned me an hour before lunch to tell me that I might be called on, and crucially, what topic I should quickly learn something about. In later years, when I was established at Harvard, I liked to visit IAS for a week at a time, as a quiet place where I could get work done. Schwarzschild and Spitzer were by then no longer active. If both Jerry and John were to be out of town on the Tuesday, John would designate me to preside over the lunch and call on people. He well remembered how much I had hated being on the receiving end. Our daughter Sarah was born in late November 1974. In mid-December, Margaret and the baby flew to Pasadena to stay with her mother, and I flew to Dallas for that year's Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics. All fall, the big excitement was the discovery by Joe Taylor at Amherst of the binary pulsar, for which they were later awarded a Nobel Prize. This was an object no one ever expected to see: two neutron stars, each more massive than our sun, in a stupendously close orbit, circling each other every 8 hours, and with one of the stars rotating on its axis 20 times per second and beaming radio pulses in our direction at that rate. The binary pulsar was a system where the effects of general theory of relativity were potentially a million times larger than could be observed in our solar system. The pulsar's rotation furnished a built-in, near-perfect clock by which the Einsteinian effects could be calibrated and measured. The binary pulsar was God's gift to Einstein, even if it arrived 20 years too late for him to know about it. Practically every theorist I knew was that fall, writing a paper on the binary pulsar, calculating one or another of the subtle effects, tests of Einstein's theory, that were now suddenly accessible to quantitative observation. Saul, with Ed Salpeter at Cornell, and also at Cornell, Tommy Gold, working alone secretly. In Princeton, Jerry Ostricker, Larry Smarr, and Roger Blandford, and Bob Wagoner and Cliff Will at Stanford. For a while, I was a collaborator on the Ostricker-Smarr-Blandford effort, but by December had removed myself. I wasn't pulling my weight, and I was privately repelled by the feeding frenzy of hurried and scientifically sloppy competition. I wanted the practice of science to emulate Chandrasekhar. I wished that everyone would take a year or two, work everything out carefully and correctly, and then publish definitive results. Instead, I was in a ringside seat on the competitive chaos. Bacall was the associate editor for Astrophysical Journal Letters, where most of the quickie papers were being submitted, and I was his favorite anonymous reviewer. I accepted some papers and rejected others. It got crazy. At the Dallas Sheraton, I introduced Saul and Roger Blandford. They had never met, and they immediately discovered that they were writing competing papers about the same relativistic effect. Still, it was in the interest of both to share their results, which turned out to disagree. Saul took Roger's calculation back to his hotel room and soon found the error. His own calculation was the correct one. Roger, however, when he worked through Saul's calculation, discovered what Saul had missed. Although formally correct, the most important effect was exactly degenerate with uncertainty about the binary's Newtonian orbit, meaning that it could not be measured at all in less than a century. The upshot was that, instead of writing competing papers, they wrote one together, disproving the effect that both initially sought to claim credit for. Saul and Roger explained this result to Joe Taylor at lunch the next day. He was impressed. Then, the middle of that same afternoon, Taylor sought them out to show them a letter from Zeldovich that had just been hand-carried from Moscow by David Pines. Zeldovich had also found the same negative result. This period was formative for me. I learned that, despite the acknowledged thrill of beating one's competitors in the quick sprint, which I had previously tasted in my work on gravitational radiation and Kerr stability, that wasn't the kind of science that I wanted to do. I wanted to have fun, and for me, that meant doing things that were creative, or offbeat, or elegant, or unexpected, and not necessarily fast, nor immediately competitive, nor crowd-following. So, spoiler alert, right there, I lost any chance of being the kind of scientist who could win a Nobel Prize. I did publish one, sole author paper, relevant to the binary pulsar, an esoteric discussion of how pulsar data might be analyzed for maximal accuracy. The paper was subsequently cited by others exactly once, by Roger Blandford, who referenced it only to dismiss it as having made unrealistic assumptions. From Dallas, I was flying to LA to spend the holidays with Sarah and Margaret at her mother's house. When the flight was diverted to San Diego because of fog at LAX, Kip, Sandor, Willie Fowler, Frank Estabrook, and I grabbed a lucky rental car and crowded in for the two-hour drive to Pasadena. In the back seat, Willie passed around his silver travel flask of bourbon, he always carried one, to Estabrook and me. Sandor was driving, but Kip, in front, uncharacteristically refused to join in. Then, at the end of the month, I was back in Pasadena for the annual Lauritsen Memorial Lecture. The Lauritsen speaker was John Wheeler. He and I were installed in adjacent visitor offices in Kip's area. I cornered him and asked point blank what was my long-term future at Princeton. He made general remarks about the department's desire to promote more second-term assistant professors than in the past. I was in my first three-year term, and by now I understood that John conveyed negative information at best obliquely. I was already not expecting to remain in Princeton for a second term. Dave Schramm and Dave Arnett at Chicago had invited me to give a colloquium and were hinting that it was more than a casual invitation. Evidently, they were getting things lined up to make me a tenure offer. since Schramm and I had shared his large tent at the 1971 Sierra Conference when he was Willie Fowler's postdoc. He had become an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin, then a tenured associate professor at Chicago. Schramm's meteoric rise was helped by push from Willie at Caltech and pull from Chandra at Chicago, not to mention Dave's own friendly, larger-than-life physical presence. Kip introduced Wheeler's lecture. Although John has been sounding crazier and crazier in recent years, it is because he dares to think about problems too difficult for any of the rest of us whose careers are on the line. Wheeler beamed. Chapter 29. Metrics. By spring, when I had been at Princeton for a little more than 6 months, I had acquired all the trappings of a proper Princetonian assistant professor. I was teaching undergraduates and graduate students. I had a graduate student of my own, Paul Weida, who was struggling to make sense of Chandra's papers on incompressible ellipsoids so that we could apply them to more realistic models of rotating neutron stars. I had an undergraduate senior thesis student, Adam Burrows, who seemed terrifically lazy, but eventually presented me with a full-blown thesis that neither I nor Tony Z, the other member of Adam's committee, could make any sense of. We didn't recommend him for a prize. Adam did his PhD at MIT and eventually returned to Princeton as a full professor, doing pioneering work on exoplanets and brown dwarf stars. I was coming up with an abundant stream of research ideas to work on. It was not obvious to me then that these new research ideas were not very good. That realization came only later. Scientists, physicists, and mathematicians especially love to rank each other. Who is better than me? Is Feynman smarter than Gell-Mann? Alicia Ostriker, when she accompanied Jerry and colleagues to Lahier's, the de rigueur Princeton restaurant for entertaining distinguished visitors, liked to keep track of how long it took before the conversation turned inevitably to the ranking of colleagues. On average, it was 12 minutes. Ranking colleagues was the astrophysicist's favorite blood sport. Until the 1970s, such orderings were necessarily subjective. That changed when computer databases made it possible to know not just how many papers a researcher had published, but how many times those papers were referred to, cited, in papers by others. This so-called bibliometrics was, still is, controversial. A wrong paper that everyone in the field likes to take a swipe at can garner a large number of citations, since bibliometrics can't easily distinguish between good and bad citations, important citations, or just-in-passing ones. One of my papers with Bardeen garnered, over time, 1,726 citations because it happened to be a good compendium of facts about the Kerr metric, but was otherwise quite forgettable. Nonetheless, citation counts do say something. While I was at Caltech, I wrote or co-authored papers ultimately cited hundreds, and in a couple of cases, thousands of times. At Princeton, my not very good research ideas, all of which seemed compelling at the time, resulted in papers cited, in some cases, only once or twice. I wasn't doing sloppy work. Rereading these papers now, I am struck by how pretty they were mathematically and how irrelevant they turned out to be. Papers don't get cited just for being pretty. Much later, I managed to write a paper that was never cited, not even by me. It was not obvious to my professional boosters, Schramm, Chandra at Chicago, George Field at Harvard, Kip at Caltech, that there was little of importance in my new work. No less in science than elsewhere, you can fool all of the people for a while. John Bachall wasn't fooled, I think, but it didn't matter. As already mentioned, it was characteristic of John to make snap judgments about people. Either he loved you or he hated you, and once set, his judgment never changed. He loved me and would write over-the-top, glowing letters about me, no matter how badly my work went. I visited the University of Chicago in March 1975. At the last minute, the department chair, Jean Parker, insisted that Margaret and baby Sarah come too, a sure sign that they were going to offer me a job. Schramm met us at the airport and gave us a tour. The Hyde Park neighborhood around the university had only just ticked up toward eventual gentrification. On the one hand, you were safe on the street at night only in the defined area that university police cars patrolled. On the other hand, the real estate bargains were spectacular. The Schramms paid $35,000, about $170,000 in 2020 dollars, for a 3,000-square-foot, high-ceiling apartment in a beautiful old building. The university put us up overnight in the Quadrangle Club on campus. The next morning, Parker handed me the offer letter. Associate professor with tenure, promotion to full professor, a formality after just a couple of years, starting at twice my Princeton salary. Chandra was by now working on his book on black holes, and he was effusive in complimenting me on my black hole work, his contribution to the recruiting pitch. Yet, interestingly, when the book finally came out in 1983, its references to my work were disappointingly sparse, often replaced by references to later work by Steve Detweiler, Chandra's own student. Saul fared much better than I did. At this meeting, however, it was all praise. Chandra then brought up another matter that I had planned to leave alone. My student, Paul Weida, had found an actual mathematical error, not just a typo, in one of Chandra's papers on incompressible ellipsoids. That never happened, and there had been an exchange of correspondence before Chandra had acknowledged that it was, in fact, an error. Now, he made oblique amends with the animated telling of an Indian fable. There was a prince who never told a lie, and his chariot rode a foot above the ground. Then, in a battle, his advisors induced him to call from a tower that the enemy leader was dead. The statement was not a lie, because there happened to be a deceased elephant of the same name. The prince's forces beat the demoralized enemy, and the prince's record for truth was in principle unspoiled. But his chariot was not fooled, and now clunked along at ground level. I had this image still in mind when I met with postdocs Bob Wald and John Friedman. They seemed glum. They were my contemporaries, but their professional chariots were just clunking along, while mine was floating. They clearly didn't think I deserved to be the prince of relativistic astrophysics. I had started with all the advantages, undeserved. Plus, what I was actually better at was, from their perspective, merely self-promotion. Notably, I was being merchandised by SRAM, himself the emperor of self-promotion. It didn't seem fair. I privately thought they were right. It wasn't fair. But it was fact, and I was going to take advantage of it. There was to be, at the end of June in beautiful Verona, Italy, an international conference on black holes and neutron stars. Attendance was by invitation only. It was one of a prestigious annual series labeled International School of Physics Enrico Fermi. I wasn't invited. Neither was Larry Smarr, nor Saul, nor for that matter any former members of Kip's group, nor anyone associated with Chandra's group in Chicago. It was not hard to understand why. The conference was organized by Remo Ruffini. We, on Remo's enemies list, were cut out. When Claudio Teitelbaum happened to mention that one of Wheeler's grant accounts held $1,200 in unallocated funds, he and I hatched a plan. We would hold a competing conference in Princeton, International School of Physics Joseph Henry. Ours was low budget, but it was also invitational. You had to be under the age of 30, and friends of Remo need not apply. You also had to be willing to sleep on the floor in a sleeping bag, many to a room. We attracted 20 participants, a number of whom later remembered the event fondly when years afterward they had become famous professors. The talks were good, and the conference banquet was a hot dog roast on the lawn behind Hibben Apartments. Apart from Verena, Ruffini was not advancing much professionally. Martin Rees and I discussed this late one night in Martin's visitor office at IAS. He seemed to always be there, working day and night. Martin felt that Remo did not deserve to be, alone among all active relativists, unemployed. After all, his only crime is selling his own work too aggressively, and I shouldn't think that any of you Americans would hold that against him. Martin was always, then and now, anti-American in this way, but he never let it get in the way of friendships with individual Americans. An exclusive summer conference that I was invited to, thanks to Kip and Zeldovich, was to be held at a resort on the outskirts of Moscow. It was canceled at the last minute. There were supposed to be just 7 Americans: Kip, David Pines, Jerry Ostricker, John Bacall, Fred Lamb, Jim Bardeen, and me. And very unusually, we were encouraged to bring our families. Kip's Soviet friends told him that there were 2 theories about why it was canceled. Either it had been supported by the losing side in the internal political struggle over who would succeed academician Mstislav Keldysh as president of the Soviet Academy of Science. Keldysh was 3 times a hero of socialist labor and a key figure in the Soviet space program. He was a member of the party's Central Committee and a delegate to the Supreme Soviet. In the event, he was succeeded as president of the Soviet Academy by Anatoly Alexandrov, who is now remembered principally as the designer of the ill-fated reactor at Chernobyl. Or, the other theory, the conference was canceled by the KGB because of the large number of Jews on the Soviet Organizing Committee, not to mention among the invited Americans. So, as in earlier summers, Margaret and I went to Cambridge, England instead, this time with Sarah, now 8 months old. King's College rented us a flat at number 8 Whichcote House, Springfield Road, that was by British standards palatial. Full large kitchen, 2 bedrooms, lounge, study, all electric, and wall-to-wall carpets for £20 a week. Sarah slept in the pulled-out bottom drawer of the bedroom dresser. It was an exceptionally good summer at the Institute of Astronomy, or maybe it just seemed so because, outside of Princeton, I was now known as a real person, on my way, it was thought, to a professorship at Chicago. Martin Rees was by now out from his Sussex exile and ensconced as the Plumian professor, Fred Hoyle's old position. Willie Fowler no longer visited, but in his place was a newer crowd, director Donald Lyndon Bell, and locals Gary Gibbons, Bill Saslaw, Michael Rowan Robinson, Bernard Jones, Peter Messaros, visitors Jerry Ostricker, Jim Gunn, Wall Sargent, Joe Silk, Virginia Trimble, Bodon Patsinski, Beatrice Tinsley, Richard Gott, Vincent Ick, Gary Steigman, Margaret Geller, and many others. Rumors had swirled that Stephen Hawking was going to leave Cambridge for a professorship at Caltech, where he had just spent a year on sabbatical in Kipp's group. But by summer 1975, he was back in Cambridge, though only as a reader. He was belatedly awarded a professorship at Cambridge in 1977 and became Lucasian professor, the chair held by Newton, Airy, Charles Babbage, and Paul Dirac, among others, in 1979. Beatrice Tinsley, I knew, was one of the 2 candidates with whom I was competing for the professorship in astronomy at Harvard. There was well-founded pressure there to hire a woman, and she was excellent. With Gott, Gunn, and Schramm, she had recently published, their names in alphabetical order, a paper with the then-provocative title, An Unbound Universe. In a cheeky tone, but with irrefutable scientific rigor, the paper brought together and analyzed the evidence that there was, in fact, not enough matter in the expanding universe to bring about its eventually turnaround and collapse. There was not even enough matter to significantly ever slow down the expansion. The universe was manifestly open, not closed. This conclusion was counter to what most observers outside of Caltech thought was true, and counter to what most theorists wanted to be true. The paper was instantly famous, and over succeeding years, it proved to be prescient. The next big piece of that puzzle waited for a quarter century until 2 groups found independently that far from slowing down, the universe was actually accelerating. More on that later. Rich Gott, Beatrice's co-author, was my former classmate at Harvard. He had gone on to do his PhD at Princeton with Spitzer, then to Caltech for a postdoc with Gunn, where we overlapped for a year. From undergraduate days on, Rich was one of the most eccentric people I ever knew. No, he was the most eccentric, excluding those belonging in the psychiatrist's diagnostic and statistical manual. But I say this with affection. I loved talking to Rich. It was prerequisite to have time on one's hands. He was a Southerner with a slow drawl who liked to examine any issue at length from all possible sides and angles, and in his case, from more than 3 dimensions. Time travel was one of his favorite topics. Another was the famously unsolved 4-color map theorem. As an undergraduate, Rich had discovered a proof that turned out to be the same as one discovered by Kempe in 1879. That proof had stood for 10 years before it was shown to be incorrect. 10 years, Rich would say. 10 years. If I had lived then, I could have been a famous mathematician for 10 years. Over time, Rich's eccentricities took a toll on his scientific reputation, but at the time, in 1975, he was a rising star. Gunn was his strong supporter. If Tinsley was the principal obstacle between me and a Harvard tenure offer, Gott was the principal obstacle to my being promoted to tenure at Princeton. I knew from John Bachall's continuing indiscretions to me that the physics department, Murph Goldberger, chair, had come up with 1/2 a position for me, conditional on the astrophysics department, Lyman Spitzer chair, coming up with the other half of a joint appointment. Astrophysics did have a full position available, but Spitzer wanted to hold it intact for Gott's eventual return. While the matter was being settled, Gott was rusticating in Cambridge as a fellow of Trinity College. Jerry Ostricker was said to be balancing in the middle. He was Spitzer's impatient heir apparent and thought, I was told this only many years later, that letting Lyman appoint a protege would accelerate the old man's transition to emeritus. That summer, a glimpse of this intrigue came through when Jerry took me aside to give me his take on the Gott Gunn Schramm Tinsley paper. Not the science, but the personalities. He wondered who actually wrote the paper. Schramm has the animal energy, of course, he said, but I doubt that he knows how to write. I mentioned that Gunn could write elegantly. No, I think that it was written by Gott, he said. Beatrice, Jerry thought, was the fall guy, the one to take the blame if, as he thought, the paper was wrong. But the paper was not wrong. Tragically, Tinsley's life ended before she could get the credit she deserved. Unable to find a job with her husband in Texas, she had divorced him and moved to Yale in 1974, in the process losing custody of her two children. In 1978, she was diagnosed with cancer. She died in the Yale infirmary in 1981 at the age of 40. That the universe was indeed unbound became established only in the late 1990s. I didn't know, that summer, that my candidacy at Princeton had already imploded. I learned the details later from, naturally, John Bachall. Murph and Lyman had a meeting with the dean, who told them that it was up to them to divide the baby me, one way or another. John met with Lyman, and, sensing some flexibility in the latter's negative position, urged him to make calls about me to Thorne, Goldreich, and Chandra. But, at a meeting with the physics principals the next day, Lyman, per John, sat there like a bump on a log and didn't say one thing in your favor or give one word of encouragement to the physics department for them to hire you. Afterwards, John asked Lyman if he had talked to any of my references. I called Jim Gunn. And that was that. Gunn recommended Gott, who arrived in Princeton as an assistant professor in January 1976 and was awarded tenure 2 years later. We were friends then and are still today. If Rich gravitated toward unproductive and eccentric areas of research during his long career at Princeton, it may in part have been because Jerry Ostricker was active in all the productive areas, and Rich may have wanted not to be seen as Jerry's understudy. That I had a valid reason for disliking Spitzer made it even harder for me to understand why everyone considered him a great theoretical astrophysicist. He did careful, obvious things, both in the pioneer years of plasma astrophysics and afterwards. He could never have commanded such respect, I thought, as a theoretical physicist, a community where cleverness, not just diligence, was coin of the realm. Nor could I understand why Lyman seemed generally well-liked by colleagues. A couple of years later, I sat next to Alan Lightman at a conference talk by Lyman, who credited no one in the field for their contributions except his own graduate students. But I won't try to remember their names, since there have been so many of them, he said dismissively. Alan, who with Stu Shapiro had done important work in exactly the same subject, came to a slow boil. This was also the summer that I got to know Margaret Geller well, another lifelong, though at times rocky, friendship. She was a Princeton PhD, supervised by Peebles, who had gone on to be a postdoc at IOA. She was only the second woman to get a Princeton PhD in physics and had horror stories about Princeton that she enjoyed telling in an animated fashion. So, we bonded immediately. She had become a postdoc at Harvard. That job offer more due to a rave recommendation from Charles Kittle, her Berkeley undergraduate advisor, than from Peebles, who wrote only faint praise. Geller's analysis of Peebles was not too different from mine. He was jealous of his own narrow field, in which he was the acknowledged world expert, and wouldn't stick his neck out for anybody, not even his own students. It was useless to go to him for advice on a scientific problem. If the problem was within his jealous perimeter, he would say nothing. If it was outside, he would have nothing to say. Geller later became a full professor and senior scientist at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. She co-discovered the fact that galaxies and clusters of galaxies are organized into large-scale structures, something that surely would have won a Nobel Prize had the assignment of credit been less murky. Peebles was awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work in exactly the part of cosmology that he for decades guarded so jealously. At the time of that final recognition, he was 84 years old. Going to Jerry Ostricker with a scientific problem was an entirely different experience. Earlier in the spring, I had gone to him with a question that came from my student Paul Wieda's work. "You know," he said, "I've been thinking about something quite similar. Why don't we all write a paper together?" Jerry was famous for these Faustian bargains. His name on a paper guaranteed that it would be taken seriously. He would contribute to any joint effort an hour or two of creative discussion, and he would read and usually improve the paper in final draft. What he wouldn't generally do was much real work. In the case of Wieda, I turned down Jerry's offer with trepidation. Not long before, I had been at an Institute astrophysics lunch where Jerry lectured on his own theory of galaxy formation in a talk that bore considerable resemblance to a recent preprint by Gott and Thuan. Daring where my colleagues feared to tread, I spoke up. "Jerry, what is the relation of this work, if any, to the recent work by Gott and Thuan?" "It's not completely independent," he said breezily. But, he added to me after lunch, caustically, "you know, Gott and Thuan were my students, not the other way around. They could have written their paper with me." Martin Rees was Jerry's opposite, a constant source of research ideas freely given away, and an outstanding communicator. Martin was so polished as a speaker that one could have listened to him read used car classified ads from the Sunday paper, and they would have seemed not just interesting, but like unified pieces of some grand intellectual edifice. From summer 1975 in Cambridge, I took away several ideas that, germinating over the next couple of years, helped me out of my Princeton work slump. Trinh Tuan, incidentally, was in Cambridge for 2 months that summer, after which he was supposed to return to his postdoc position at Caltech. When he went to the U.S. Embassy in London to get his return visa, he learned that he was now a stateless person. He had been in the United States on an exchange visa, but now that there was suddenly no longer any South Vietnam, there could obviously be, they told him, no further exchange. Could he then come to the United States as a refugee? Obviously not, because he had already been in the U.S. and left voluntarily for the summer in England. His job, belongings, furniture were all back in Pasadena, where he was still paying rent on his apartment. The only good news was that, as an officially stateless person, he could not be deported anywhere by the UK. The eventual solution was that the embassy in London gave him not a visa, but an official letter to the airline stating that the normal penalty for transporting a visa-less foreigner would be waived in his case. Then, when he arrived in Los Angeles, he would be at the mercy of the immigration officials, except that in the US, as in the UK, a stateless person could not be deported. The summer passed pleasantly, with fried duck and pancakes at the Peking restaurant on Burley Street, visits to the Fort St. George pub on Midsummer's Green. Cream teas, tea, sugar, milk, hot water, bread and butter, jam, cucumber sandwiches, scones, cakes, and whipped double cream at the Orchard in Grantchester or the Garden in Coton, where we often ran into the Guns or Linden Bells, and dinners at the Red Lion Inn in Grantchester. Rich Gott took us to high table at Trinity, smoked salmon, roast pork, dressing, asparagus, potatoes, ice cream and cookies, sardine on toast and wine, of course. Then up to the port room for the candlelit port ceremony, the vote on whether to have claret in addition, it always passed. Then 3 rounds of port, Madeira, claret, and, since this was the summer, Sauterne. Then also fruit, cheese, cigars and snuff, the last from a large silver snuff box. Margaret finished off the claret bottle on her turn, a so-called buzz, which entitled her to a free glass when they brought out the next bottle. Rich told us that he thought of Trinity as a long-voyage starship, self-contained and surviving through the ages, generation upon generation, by means of long-held, closely maintained traditions. Its crew had by now long forgotten exactly what was their destination and what their mission was supposed to be when they arrived. Robert Heinlein's 1941 novella, Orphans of the Sky, had a similar premise. Chapter 30, Ticket Out, our way home from England involved a detour to a relativity workshop conference in Wales. Bernie Schutz, Kip's former graduate student, was by now a professor at Cardiff University. He and Roger Penrose had organized the conference. Gregonog was the university's conference center, a huge Tudor manor house set in 750 acres of parkland. We were arriving a day early. A girl who could not have been even 18 escorted us through the long hallway, the dining room, the front hall, up two flights of carpeted marble stairs to our bedroom, which included a crib for Sarah. We explored the empty house, sitting rooms, meeting rooms, common room, senior common room, a library with 10,000 old books, a music room with pipe organ and two pianos, and about 50 bedrooms. The refectory, when we made our way there at dinner time, was empty and dark, but two places had been set by unseen hands for us, dinner platters of cold cuts and trimmings. We sensed the presence of ghosts, centuries of Tudor princes of Wales. But we learned the next day that the manor was actually a recreation built in the mid-19th century by a Welsh cement magnate. A few years previous, it had been featured in the Concrete Quarterly. Its walls were made of cement. In the 1920s, it was a musical center and hosted concerts by Elgar and Holst, who played the pianos that we now plinked. The next day, at coffee in a paneled room after dinner, Penrose told me about a mathematical game that he had invented, a kind of jigsaw puzzle with just two kinds of pieces, differently proportioned diamonds that could cover the whole plane, but not in any regular pattern. The game was to get as far as you could in the covering before you ran into trouble, produced a gap that neither diamond would fit. I asked about some details, and he ran back to his room, returning with a handmade set of wooden pieces. Although he could prove that the whole plane could be covered, it was a simple proof involving the Fibonacci numbers that even I could understand. He had never actually seen an example with more than a couple of dozen puzzle pieces. This was catnip to me. Implicit in his proof was an algorithm that could be programmed on a computer. I promised to send Roger a computer-drawn blueprint that would show him a solution with many thousands of puzzle pieces, and eventually made good on this promise. In the 1980s and 1990s, a periodic lattices, including Penrose's, were found to occur in nature, at the atomic level, in so-called quasicrystals, now a pretty subfield of condensed matter physics. A Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded for their experimental identification. Back in Princeton that fall, I was teaching an undergraduate class in mathematical methods of physics to a class of exactly 5 enrolled undergraduates. 5 was a magic number. If any one of them dropped out, the class would be canceled, and I would be assigned to teach some unwelcome number of freshman lab sections. John and Jeanette Wheeler held a welcoming Einstein-Maxwell picnic. My curiosity on how and why John insisted on naming events after great men was mostly played out, but I did wonder why Bohr had not been included. Even after so many decades, I am ambivalent about the Princeton that I experienced in the 1970s. It launched me professionally in a way that Caltech could never have done. It was the active center of the universe in theoretical astrophysics, one of my fields, and, via Einstein, the historical center of the universe in my other field, relativity. Spitzer and Schwarzschild were the great astrophysicists of their generation. Ostricker, along with Martin Rees on the other side of the Atlantic, was the rising star of his. Everyone who was anyone in astronomy visited Princeton frequently. Caltech, which owned Palomar Observatory, ruled the observational roost, but the strong Caltech-Princeton-Cambridge, UK axis benefited all three institutions. After I had my Chicago job offer, I asked Martin for advice. He told me that it would be a mistake to leave any job at Princeton, even a non-tenured one. I should hold on there as long as I could. After all, it is the best place in the world. On the other hand, I hated the place. I hated its petty academic jealousies, its small-town small-mindedness. I hated the genteel southern veneer, where you were never supposed to even hint to a person's face what you really thought of them, but made sure behind their back that everyone else in town knew. It didn't help that I was, myself, an arrogant young scientist with a strong streak of paranoia, an infant daughter, and an unemployed, unhappy wife. To give it its due, Princeton was changing. It had been announced to the junior faculty with some fanfare that we were now allowed to use the senior faculty shower on the third floor of Jadwin Hall, the one used by senior faculty after their tennis games, we were told to bring our own soap. I had a figurative ticket out of Princeton, a ticket to Chicago, but it was going to expire within weeks. There was only so long that I could keep Shram and Chandra waiting for an answer. Harvard was still in play. I spoke regularly by phone with George Field, and he was trying to get me an offer. But the situation was complicated in ways unique to Harvard. These bear mentioning. Outside of the professional schools, law, medicine, etc., all Harvard departments were under the purview of the Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. There were other lesser deans, but it was then Henry Rosofsky, was the dean. Rosofsky later famously turned down an offer to become president of Yale, its first Jewish president, leaving Yale's actual first Jewish president to be Rick Levin, appointed in 1993, whom I came to know well. But that is much later in the story. As at other universities, each department at Harvard had its faculty lines to fill. At Harvard, these were literally lines drawn in a bound ledger book, jealously guarded by Miss Johnson, the dean's septuagenarian secretary. Each department had a few pages with blue-ruled rows that were labeled down the page by calendar year. The pages were divided into columns by vertical red rule lines. The names of tenured professors were inscribed by Miss Johnson, in pencil, on lines that corresponded to their future dates of retirement. At the time, a rigidly enforced age 67. When a retirement came, that professor's younger successor would be entered, one column to the right, on a future retirement year's line farther down the page, and a line would be drawn, diagonally, connecting the old and the new in an unbroken chain. Those were the faculty lines. The whole thing was called a Graustein chart, after the long-dead dean who invented it. When George Field was recruited from Berkeley, as the first joint Harvard-Smithsonian director of the new Center for Astrophysics, Miss Johnson's ledger connected him to the retiring Fred Whipple. However, the next retirements were years distant, so George had negotiated with the dean for three new lines in astronomy. One can be sure that Miss Johnson disapproved of the anomaly. Al Cameron had been recruited to the first of these new lines. My offer, if I got one, would be the second. The remaining line was to be filled with an optical observational astronomer. Departments voted on tenure offers, but a numerical plurality was meaningless, because every voting professor was required to write a confidential letter to the dean explaining his vote. One might vote for one candidate and then, concocting an explanation, recommend a different one to the dean. It was a given that one's letter to the dean should try to undercut the positions of professors with contrary views. From the letters received, or otherwise, by some mysterious process, the dean would come up with 3 to 5 names of candidates and himself write to experts at other universities. Those letters, typed by Miss Johnson, were formulaic. Which of these men, only later people, is the best in the world in his field? The locution wasn't the best that we can attract or among the best. It was the best. That formulation had worked for Harvard since time immemorial, but by the 1970s, it was becoming frayed around the edges. Recipients of the dean's letter would generally telephone someone they knew in the department to find out who the department really wanted, and then, if they concurred, warp their letters to make that person the best in the world, in some carefully defined subfield. Of course, the dean knew this was happening and would correct for it in interpreting the responses. The appointment process was not then finished, not nearly. For each appointment, the dean would ask the president of Harvard, at the time Derek Bok, to schedule a so-called ad hoc committee. 2 or 3 outside experts were invited to travel to Cambridge. They, plus 1 or 2 Harvard faculty from outside the requesting department, would meet with the president and dean, generally for a full morning. Testimony would be heard from the department chair and other professors, pro and con. The ad hoc members didn't vote. They only advised the president, who, when the meeting was adjourned, generally took them to lunch in a private room at the faculty club and rarely indicated what his decision, the final one, might be. President Bok generally delivered his verdict by phone to the department chair the day after the ad hoc meeting. Are we done? Not necessarily. While the president might simply, after all this fuss, approve the candidate originally voted by the department, he might instead, This happened about a third of the time. Send back to the department a completely different name, or even more than one. It was then up to the department whether to accept one of these, or make no appointment at all. This was all at the time opaque to me, except insofar as John Bachall's sources provided not always reliable glimpses. I was elated when George Field called me in mid-September to say that the astronomy department had voted to offer me a full professorship. It was another quirk of Harvard that full professor was the only tenured rank. At Chicago, I would have started as a tenured associate professor. George knew, though I didn't, that several faculty were planning to write opposing letters to the dean. I was devastated when, sometime later, Bachall told me that Dean Rosofsky's letter to him solicited opinions on alphabetically listed Arnett, Press, Silk, Tinsley, and Wagner. Except for Beatrice, these were people a decade senior to me. Their published corpus vastly outweighed mine. Dave Arnett, at Chicago, was someone I admired, and he was a part of the effort to recruit me there. But he had been Al Cameron's PhD student, and Cameron, now at Harvard just 1 year, was supporting him. The ad hoc was scheduled for mid-October. As the date approached, the motivational phone calls from Field became fewer and less upbeat, and Bachall's sources all went radio silent. John's interpretation, like mine, was that the astronomers in Cambridge were now expecting a decision in favor of Dave Arnett, or possibly Beatrice. If for any reason you don't want to go to Chicago, I can get you a 5-year appointment here at the Institute, John told me. He knew how unhappy I was in Princeton's physics department. He didn't understand that I hated the entire borough and township of Princeton, and possibly even the adjoining townships of Lawrence and Hopewell. Chandra happened to be visiting Princeton during the final 2 weeks of my waiting. He and Lalitha were longtime friends of the Schwarzschilds and often stayed at their house. He once told me that these were unofficial visits, and that his last official visit to Princeton had been in 1967. I was impressed by his making the distinction, as royalty might. We had substantive discussions about who we might recruit to Chicago as assistant professors. Doug Eardley was a top candidate. Chandra told me that Chicago wanted me for my best qualities, scholarship and depth, while Harvard, if they came through at all, wanted me for my least attractive, marketability, charisma, and salesmanship. He was exactly right about this. My Chicago ticket was looking better and better. George finally called me the day after the ad hoc. He was downbeat. It was unusual that there was as yet no verdict. I may have failed to present your case in the best light, he said, cryptically and ominously. A glimmer of hope was that two of the outside members, names kept secret, even from him, until the meeting, were old relativity friends of mine, Charlie Misner and Stan Deser. Deser had been in my office at Princeton just the previous spring, where he had noticed the page proofs of Problem Book in Relativity, now finally about to be published, and had been wildly enthusiastic. I later learned the source of Field's pessimism. One of the outside letters had made a whole series of unfavorable points about me in the form of rhetorical questions. Called to testify, Field was blindsided by Bach's and Rosofsky's going down the list and demanding answers to each, rather than letting him present the positive case. The letter might have been Gunn's. Then or later, I never asked either Field or Gunn Porming. After more than a week of silence, I got a phone call from Alex Dalgarno, the astronomy department chair, a rotating position subordinate to George Field's. The recommendation of our department that you be made an appointment has at last been acted on by the dean and president. I waited for the bad news, and they have approved it. I knew immediately that I would pick Harvard. It was irrational, but the very real merits of Chicago, even Chandra's final pitch, simply evaporated in my mind. Was this a baby duck patterning thing because I had been a Harvard undergraduate? There must be a parallel universe in which I never left California, in which I was a Berkeley undergraduate with Margaret, then went to graduate school at Caltech and worked with Kip, just as in our universe's timeline. In most ways, I might be, in that universe, not very different from in this one. But in that universe, I surely would have gone to Chicago instead of Harvard.